Chapter 33, Healthcare, Now What? Donald Trump's healthcare plan, as expressed during his campaign, was as follows. Repeal Obamacare and replace it with something terrific. Okay, that's not the entire plan. Trump later elaborated on something terrific, explaining that his plan would be so much better, so much better, so much better. When he was elected, it became clear that repeal was now a real possibility. The replace part, however, was as much a mystery as it had always been. Over the previous 6 years, Republicans had voted more than 60 times to repeal the law. They had offered zero plans to replace it. That's not to say they didn't have ideas related to health care. For example, Republicans have always been big on tort reform, which means making it harder to sue for malpractice. Then there's the one actual idea Trump offered during the campaign, which is to allow health insurance companies to sell insurance plans across state lines. Here's the thing about that, by the way. There is no federal law that prevents it. It's up to the states to decide which health insurance companies can sell within their borders. In fact, since the ACA passed, 6 states have allowed insurance companies from outside their borders to offer policies to their citizens. And guess what? No health insurance company has done it. Why? Because in order to offer coverage in a given state, you need more than a license to do it. You need to learn the state, assess the healthcare needs of its population, set up a network of providers willing to accept your insurance, and advertise to customers. So that barely counts as an idea, and more importantly, it has nothing to do with the central challenge of healthcare reform, which is making sure that nobody in America goes bankrupt because they get sick or hurt, or worse, goes without care they need because they can't afford it. By the time you listen to this, Republicans may well have succeeded in repealing some or all of the Affordable Care Act. But I'm willing to bet that they won't have succeeded in replacing it, because the truth is they've never been interested in addressing that central challenge. And they've been proving just how uninterested they are since the very beginning of this debate. Let's go back to 2008, when Barack Obama first ran for president and I first ran for the Senate. Getting to universal health care was at the center of our respective campaigns, and for good reason. Every developed country in the world had some form of universal health care except the United States, providing care for all their people, and doing it at about half the cost and with better outcomes. During one of our debates, Norm Coleman had insisted that the United States already had the best healthcare system in the world, pointing to the Mayo Clinic in our home state. True, Mayo provides healthcare that is second to none on the planet, which is why Mayo is such a point of pride in Minnesota. The problem was that great healthcare delivered by a number of world-class hospitals and clinics doesn't make a health system. As T.R. Reid pointed out in his 2009 bestseller, The Healing of America, the United States didn't have a health system. We had a number of health systems. If you're Medicare or Medicaid, you're in the Canadian system, single payer. If you're in the military or the VA, you're in the British system, socialized medicine. If you got your insurance through your employer, as most Americans did, you were in the German system. But if you didn't have any health insurance, you were in the Cambodian system, where one illness or injury could literally ruin or even end your life. More than half of all personal bankruptcies in America were caused, in part or entirely, by a health care crisis. And that statistic doesn't even count all the people, like Margie Hogan's young lupus patient, who were going without care that they needed because they didn't have insurance to pay for it. One reason so many people were trapped in the Cambodian system was that, before Obamacare, insurance companies could turn you down or charge you outrageous and possible premiums for coverage if you had a pre-existing condition like cancer, heart disease, or diabetes. I know it's hard to believe, but way back in 2009, that's the way it was. Nowadays, of course, pretty much everyone agrees that this is cruel and wrong. Even Donald Trump agrees. If you want everyone to have the security of health insurance, You can't let insurance companies deny coverage to people who have pre-existing conditions. But here's the catch. If no one can be turned down or charged more for having a pre-existing condition, well, then there's no incentive to actually get health insurance until the moment you need to use it. You might as well wait until you develop lupus or get a light bulb stuck up your butt before buying a policy. This is known as the free rider problem. If only sick or light-bulbed people have insurance, then insurance becomes impossibly expensive to provide, and thus impossibly expensive to afford. So, if you want sick people to be able to get insurance without the insurance market collapsing, then healthy people have to have insurance too. Of course, some people in the Cambodian system didn't have insurance, not because they couldn't get an insurance company to cover them, but rather because they didn't have a job that provided insurance and didn't have the money to buy a policy on their own. So if you're going to require that everybody get insurance, you have to subsidize it for people who can't afford it otherwise. Hey, wait a minute. A lifeline out of the Cambodian system for people who didn't have insurance. An individual mandate to avoid the free rider problem. Subsidies to make sure that people can afford the insurance they're required to have. This sounds an awful lot like Obamacare. And, of course, that's exactly the three-legged stool that formed the foundation of the Affordable Care Act. Here's what's important to understand about this model. The stool only works with all three legs. Without the subsidies, you can't have the mandate. Without the mandate, you can't have the ban on discrimination against people with pre-existing conditions. And without those protections for the most vulnerable Americans, you're right back where you started. If this sounds like a complicated way to solve the problem, well, it is. A simpler solution would have been just to go to a national single-payer plan like Canada's, Medicare for everyone. And many progressives, like Bernie Sanders, thought that that's what we should do back in 2009. Unfortunately, we needed 60 votes to pass anything, and we were, about 50 votes short. What would a conservative solution to the Cambodian system problem look like? Well, actually a lot like Obamacare. The three-legged stool model, in fact, originated with the very conservative Heritage Foundation and had been enacted in Massachusetts under a Republican governor with the improbable name of Mitt. Where, by the way, it worked extremely well. RomneyCare now covers 97% of Bay Staters, and both Republicans and Democrats there intend to keep it intact. No matter what Trump and my Republican colleagues do to Obamacare between the time I finish this book and the time you listen to it. So, if Republicans had any interest in getting people out of the Cambodian system, they could have supported the conservative framework in the Affordable Care Act. Or they could have offered some other alternative plan. But they refused to do either. Max Baucus, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, was determined to get a bipartisan bill. And in April 2009, he'd put together a gang of six, three Democrats, three Republicans, to start negotiating. Every Tuesday, when we meet for our caucus lunch, he'd report that they were getting closer to an agreement. This went on for months. Finally, at a lunch in late September 2009, Max acknowledged that the gang of six was at a complete impasse, and that he had finally concluded that Republicans never had any intention of reaching an agreement, no matter what was in it. At this, former Republican Arlen Specter interjected, "Well, I could have told you that." "Well, then why didn't you?" I thought to myself. By then, however, a tiny window had opened to allow us to get it done on our own without any help from the Republicans. Remember, when President Obama was sworn in, he had 58 Democratic votes. In April, Arlen Specter made it 59. But by the time I got there in July to make it 60, Ted Kennedy was bedridden in Hyannisport in the final stages of his battle with brain cancer, so we still really had only 59. Senator Kennedy passed away in late August. On September 24th, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick appointed Paul Kirk to fill his seat until a new senator could be picked in a special election the next January. Finally, for the first time, Democrats actually had the 60 votes we would need to move forward on health care. The bad news is that we would need every single one of those 60 votes, which meant every single one of us had a veto. Good luck, Harry Reid. Fortunately, Harry was exactly the right guy for this impossible job. Harry grew up in the hardscrabble Nevada mining town of Searchlight. He put himself through law school as a Capitol police officer. As chairman of the Nevada Gaming Commission, he had taken on the mob. His wife, Landra, once famously found a bomb attached to their car. Simply put, Harry Reid is a hard ass. As a young man, he had been a boxer. I once heard President Obama repeat what Harry told him about his career in the ring. I wasn't the most talented guy. I wasn't very fast. I wasn't big, obviously. But I could take a punch. Harry's job on health care was to take punches for President Obama and for everyone who was counting on him to deliver on the promise of reform. And boy, did he take a lot of punches. But he got it done. And that's why Harry Reid will always be a hero to me. Still, the math was a math, and it forced us to make some tough compromises. A handful of moderate to conservative Democrats were opposed to the public option, which would have increased competition in the insurance market. Gone. Someone floated the idea of lowering the age of Medicare to 55. Not a bad idea. Makes both pools healthier. Medicare adds some people between 55 and 65 who are, on average, healthier than people over 65, while the private health insurance market loses its oldest members. Okay, let's do it. But then Joe Lieberman announced on Face the Nation that he was against it. Gone. In November, we hit another hurdle. Ben Nelson told us he decided he needed tighter restrictions on federal funding for abortions. Great. Barbara Boxer, the Senate's staunchest supporter of a woman's right to choose, bit the bullet and negotiated a compromise with Ben. Women would have to make a separate second payment to their insurer to get coverage for abortion. We didn't like it, but we didn't have a choice. Finally, on Christmas Eve, we passed the bill through the Senate. Phew. Then, suddenly, things got even harder. In January, the not-whip-smart Scott Brown, a Tea Party Republican, won the special election for Ted Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts. Democrats freaked out. Many saw Brown's victory as a sign that the Republican strategy was paying off so handsomely that it could give them control of Congress in that November's midterms and set the president up for a defeat in his 2012 reelection campaign. On top of that, our math problem had just gotten a lot worse. Because once Brown took office in early February, that would be the end of our 60-vote, filibuster-proof supermajority. Wait, you're thinking, I thought you already passed the bill. Well, we had, and so had the House, but there were some differences between the two bills. Ordinarily, this wouldn't be a big deal. We'd convene a conference committee, hash out the differences, and then both chambers would vote to pass the unified bill that came out of the conference. But Republicans were still hell-bent on stopping us from passing health care reform, and now that they once again had 41 votes in the Senate, they could stop us from voting on that unified bill. So a conference committee would be out of the question. There was only one solution. The House would have to pass the exact same bill we had just passed. Guess who didn't like that idea? House Democrats. Liberals wanted provisions from the House's more progressive bill, and Democrats from more conservative districts were now spooked by Brown's victory in Massachusetts. We were stuck, and we needed the most important Democrat in the country to decide on a plan. No, not Rachel Maddow. President Obama. Unfortunately, many of the Democrats who were freaking out about Scott Brown's victory worked for the president. And some, most notably Obama's chief of staff Rahm Emanuel, wanted to give up and abandon health care reform altogether. It all came to a head on February 4th, 2010, the day Scott Brown was sworn in. That day, President Obama spoke to Senate Democrats at a one-day emergency retreat at the Newseum, urging us to finish the job on health care. Except he didn't explain how he thought we could do that. When the president finished, the press left the room with him. Paul Begala, Tim Kaine, then chair of the Democratic National Committee, and David Axelrod were set to speak for about 5 minutes each and then take questions. Okay, I thought. Here comes the plan. Begala spoke for 5 minutes. Nothing about health care. Kaine spoke for 5 minutes. Again, nothing. Okay, I thought. I guess they're having Axelrod do it. After all, he's the president's chief political advisor, his guru, his guy. He's going to tell us the plan. David started talking. First minute, nothing on health care. Saving it for the end. Classic. Second minute, still nothing. Same with the third. Between minute 4 and minute 5, it occurred to me that one of two things was about to happen. Either Axelrod was going to run over his allotted time, or he wasn't going to tell us the friggin' plan. And indeed, when he finished his 5-minute remarks, there was not one word about how we were going to solve the intractable political crisis facing the most important legislation in a generation. Questions. My hand shot up. Senator Franken. I exploded. I've been doing a slow burn for the last 5 minutes. I cannot believe we're not talking about health care. This is the president's signature legislation. We've been working on this for a year now. The House obviously has to pass exactly what we passed, word for word. What is the plan to make that happen? That's exactly what I said, except I dropped the F-bomb maybe 50 times. Axelrod responded that I wasn't being fair to the president, and that if I could tell him how to get the 218 votes in the House, he'd be happy to pass along my advice. That's the president's job, I yelled, inserting a single F-bomb before job. After some more back and forth, Bill Nelson and Carl Levin raised their hands. Each pointed out to Axelrod that he hadn't actually answered my question, although they managed not to swear at him, which was probably easy for Bill, a very devout Christian. And later that evening, President Obama announced at a Democratic National Committee fundraiser that he wanted the House to move forward with the Senate bill. Finally, after a few hair-raising weeks of negotiations and arm-twisting, the House passed the Senate bill as it was by a 219-212 margin, and the president signed the bill into law. For Axelrod's part, he didn't take my outburst personally. I think it probably helped that after the bill passed, I wrote him a nice note. It read, "You're welcome." The story of how the Affordable Care Act passed, then, goes something like this. Democrats looked at all the people who were one car accident or cancer diagnosis away from disaster, and all the people who were getting sick or even dying because they were trapped in the Cambodian system. And they saw it as a moral crisis. And they were willing to do whatever it took to address that moral crisis, navigating a narrow path through a political maze, voting for elements of the bill that they felt were imperfect or even counterproductive, opening themselves up to demagoguery or maybe even losing their jobs, swearing at David Axelrod. And Republicans? Well, I'm sure many of them felt bad for people like Margie's lupus patient, but I just think they cared more about winning the political fight, catering to the free market ideologues and conspiracy theorists in their base, and continuing to put up that unified front against President Obama. I don't think they were willing to do the work or make the sacrifices necessary to solve the problem. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that's changed since 2010. Because they've spent the last 7 years trying to stop the Affordable Care Act from working the way it was intended. For example, a group of Republican state attorneys general filed a lawsuit claiming that the individual mandate, the second leg of the stool, was unconstitutional because the federal government didn't have the power to force people to buy something. For 2 years, as the case worked its way through the court system, we were treated to constant rhetoric about Obama's unconstitutional overreach, and nobody was sure if the law would be allowed to stand. This, of course, was despite the fact that the Republicans' argument was ridiculous. You see, and this is important, the Founding Fathers wrote a constitution that gave almost all power to state governments and very, very little to the federal government. That constitution was called the Articles of Confederation, and it was a disaster. Then the founders wrote the United States Constitution, the one we have been living under since 1789. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of that Constitution grants Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce. Gee, you think the pharmaceuticals and medical devices used in healthcare involve any interstate commerce? That's why, as expected, when the court ruled in June 2012, its four liberal justices correctly voted to uphold the individual mandate under the Commerce Clause. But after a series of earth-shatteringly, mind-blowingly partisan 5-4 rulings, everyone had worried that the five conservative justices would swallow the Republicans' insane argument. And believe it or not, they did. But Chief Justice John Roberts, custodian of the court's reputation, knew that killing health care reform with a third highly partisan, legally dubious, and immensely impactful 5-4 decision on the heels of Bush v. Gore and Citizens United might undermine any remaining confidence in the court's integrity once and for all. So Roberts voted with the liberals, agreeing that the mandate was constitutional. But he picked a different rationale, concluding that the mandate was allowable because the penalty imposed on people who didn't buy insurance was really a tax, which Congress is empowered by the Constitution to implement. Roberts' reasoning was so weird that Supreme Court reporters from both CNN and Fox News initially reported the ruling wrong. Also, critically, Roberts' decision included a drive-by shooting. It eliminated the requirement that states use federal dollars to expand their Medicaid programs, which would have helped cover millions more low-income Americans. An expert marksman, Roberts had aimed directly at the ACA's foot, weakening the law before it could even go into effect. Republicans hadn't succeeded in getting the court to block Obamacare, but they could take solace in the fact that Chief Justice Roberts had made it less good. The fact that the Affordable Care Act isn't perfect isn't entirely Republicans' fault. For example, there was a day in October 2013 when the new health insurance exchanges went live, and healthcare.gov, the website where people could shop for different policies, immediately crapped the bed. This was a really bad, unforced error by the Obama administration, and people were right to be mad about it. I was furious. Another thing that really cheesed me off was the phone number. The administration had set up an 800 number for people to call to get help finding the right insurance plan for them. Great idea. What was the number? 1-800-GET-CARE? 1-800-ACA-HELP? 1-800-NOT-SICK? No, it was 1-800-318-2596. What does that spell? Nothing. If you added an extra digit to the end, you could get to 1-800-318-A-LINKS. But come on! You know how earlier I said the reason Democrats are bad at messaging isn't that we're idiots? Well, sometimes it is. And yes, some people have gotten the short end of the stick when it comes to the new law. Just a few weeks before the 2016 presidential election, voters learned that the average premium on the health insurance exchanges, established by the Affordable Care Act, was about to go up nearly 20%. These premium hikes presented a real hardship for many Americans, especially those in rural communities where the insurance markets feature less competition and offer consumers fewer choices in health insurers. Anyone who has to pay unreasonably high premiums or co-pays and whose income is just a little too much to qualify for a subsidy that could help has every right to be angry. But ask yourself who you should be angry at. That premium hike happened in no small part because fewer healthy people than expected signed up for health insurance through the exchanges, meaning the overall pool of people in the exchanges was sicker than expected, meaning that insurance companies participating in the exchanges were losing money, which led those insurance companies to bail on the exchanges. Why did fewer healthy people than expected sign up? Well, it probably didn't help that the Koch brothers ran ads featuring a demented Uncle Sam performing a gynecological exam on a millennial to scare young people away from the exchanges. Also, Republican state health commissioners did, quote, everything in their power to be an obstructionist. I said, quote, because those words were actually spoken by Republican Insurance Commissioner Ralph Hudgens from Georgia. That's not the only way Republicans sabotage the exchanges. They also deliberately changed the law to more or less guarantee that this would happen. You see, when we set up Obamacare, we'd anticipated exactly this problem, that the people signing up for insurance might be sicker than expected. So we built into the law several programs to mitigate the risk insurers faced when they entered this new market, helping make up for initial losses and keep them in the insurance market. One important program was called Risk Corridors, another example of Democratic messaging genius. But Republicans, led by the wilier-than-you-might-have-expected Marco Rubio, snuck a rider into a spending bill that killed off risk corridors, which meant insurance companies wound up only getting compensated for about 12% of what they were owed. Thus, a bunch of insurers waltzed. Premium shot up, and Rubio and his friends rubbed their hands together while cackling gleefully. Of course, we could easily be working on fixing the problem that caused these premium increases in the first place, perhaps by giving people more incentive to sign up for the exchanges, perhaps by changing the formulas for how insurance is subsidized for low and middle income people, perhaps by bringing back the idea of a public option to increase competition. As recently as November 7th, 2016, I was very excited about implementing these ideas as part of the new Democratic Senate majority under President Clinton. In fact, from the moment the law passed, Democrats have been open, even eager, to talk about how to improve it and address problems that have arisen as the law has taken effect. Because figuring out how to improve laws and address problems is kind of Congress's job. But Republicans have shown no interest in fixing Obamacare. And while it may be easy to dismiss their intransigence as politics as usual, that isn't how things usually go. For example, many Republicans vehemently opposed the creation of Social Security and then of Medicare, but that didn't stop them from supporting and in some cases even suggesting ways to improve those laws as it became clear where they needed improvement. One of President Bush's signature domestic programs was an expansion of Medicare. That's how things are supposed to work. If you are privileged enough to have a job as a lawmaker, part of your job is to make laws, and if you don't like the way the law is working, your job is to help make it work better. But that's not what Republicans thought their job was. Just like with the stimulus, they first tried to stop health care reform from happening at all, which was their right. But then they tried to make it as ineffective as possible so they could complain that it wasn't working. Since then, they voted more than 6 times to repeal it, even shutting down the government over health care reform in an effort led by Ted Cruz, about whom I'll have a word or two later in the book. Neither of them good. And, of course, They lied about it the whole way. Before it passed, they confidently predicted horrors that never wound up happening. Obamacare is going to force more Americans into working part-time so their employer doesn't have to provide them health care. Employers are going to stop covering their employees and dump them into the exchanges. Nope, none of that happened. After it passed, they started inventing horrors to complain about. Obamacare has killed millions of jobs, they said millions of times. In fact, since the ACA passed, our economy has created more than 16 million new jobs. And even though some people have had a bad experience with the new law, the fact is that for most Americans, the law is unquestionably a net winner. Most Americans, around two-thirds of workers, continue to get their insurance through their employer. In the decade before Obamacare became law, their premiums rose at an average of 7.1% per year. In 2016, their premiums rose by an average of 2.9%. As for the 4% of Americans who get their insurance through the exchanges, roughly 80% of them receive subsidies. Nearly 3 out of 4 have the option of purchasing coverage for less than $75 a month. As for our healthcare system, it's on steadier footing than it's ever been. Before the ACA, the growing cost of healthcare had become unsustainable, more than doubling over the previous 10 years, and even threatening the long-term future of Medicare. That's why the law included measures designed to try to restrain that growth, what's known as bending the cost curve. This isn't the most exciting part of healthcare reform, except to me, which is why we had to sex it up with an exciting catchphrase like bending the cost curve. But it's important, so bear with me for a minute. Early on in the debate, I became fascinated with an article in The New Yorker by Atul Gawande, a surgeon, public health researcher, and professor at Harvard School of Public Health, who had been a frequent guest on my radio show. His piece compared Medicare spending in McAllen, Texas, with Medicare spending at the Mayo Clinic in my home state. McAllen was spending 3 times more per person than Mayo was, even as Mayo was delivering far better outcomes. Huh. Clearly, Mayo was delivering health care more efficiently and effectively than McAllen. If we could figure out how and spread those methods to other places, we could improve outcomes even while, here it comes, bending the cost curve. One of the methods Mayo used was something called coordinated care. By the time people get into Medicare, they usually have more than one thing wrong with them. As a 70-something woman told me at the Minnesota State Fair that summer, at my age, everything is pre-existing. So the Mayo Clinic has every specialty, cardiology, orthopedics, oncology, in one location. Smart. Another thing. At Mayo, all the doctors are on salary. What they get paid doesn't depend on how many tests they order or how many procedures they perform. Doctors at Mayo see their patients as patients. In McAllen, on the other hand, doctors were paid by the procedure, which meant they were incentivized to see patients as profit centers. For example, as Gawande reported, doctors in McAllen owned the imaging centers. So they made money on every CAT scan and MRI they ordered. And no surprise, they ordered a lot of CAT scans and MRIs. Meanwhile, a doctor in a system like that gets nothing if a patient avoids getting diabetes. But there's a big payday for a surgeon if he gets to remove a diabetic's foot. No wonder so much money was getting spent on health care that didn't actually make people healthier. Because of screwy incentives, doctors in McAllen, like in much of America, weren't delivering health care. They were delivering sick care. If we could get more places to do health care like Mayo and not like McAllen, we could make a big difference. This area of focus is known as delivery reform. And there's another reason I was so focused on it. As it turns out, Minnesota is really good at delivering quality and cost-effective care, consistently leading national rankings. If every state did health care as well as Minnesota does, we'd spend less and have better outcomes. I've always seen it as part of my job to bring the best of my state to Washington, and I was able to bring two Minnesota innovations to the healthcare debate that made it into law. One is called the National Diabetes Prevention Program, and it offers nutritional instruction and physical training to pre-diabetics, reducing the odds that they'll develop diabetes, which is far more expensive to treat than it is to prevent. The other is called the Medical Loss Ratio, or MLR, which mandates insurance companies spend at least 80 cents of every dollar you pay in health insurance premiums on actual health care, as opposed to administrative costs, marketing, CEO salaries, or profits. And that, if an insurance company fails to meet that standard, it has to rebate the difference to policyholders. Thanks to these reforms and many others, the law has been hugely successful in bending the cost curve. Since it passed, the cost of health care has indeed continued to rise, but has been rising at about half the rate it had during the previous decade. And in four of the last 5 years, the growth in health care spending has been slower than at any other time in the last half century. As for McAllen, Texas, the city that had the highest Medicare spending per capita in the country, McAllen has brought down the cost of its health care for Medicare recipients by nearly $3,000 per capita because of incentives in the ACA to reward coordinated care and other health care delivery reforms. Forget about bending the curve. This was reversing it altogether. Repealing Obamacare means wiping out all that progress, not just the delivery reform, but the 20 million people who didn't have insurance and got it thanks to the ACA, and the 153 million people with pre-existing conditions who were saved from worrying that they'd be discriminated against, and all the young adults who gained the ability to stay on their parents' insurance, and every American who got a flu shot or a long overdue checkup and didn't get handed a bill at the end. All these people have a lot riding on whether Republicans really mean it when they say they're going to replace Obamacare with something that protects them. After Trump won the presidency, repeal and replace was itself replaced with repeal and delay. The idea was that the Affordable Care Act would be repealed immediately, but the repeal wouldn't go into effect until after the 2018 midterm elections, thus buying Republicans some time to think of an idea for how to replace it. The only way this isn't the dumbest idea in the world is if the thing you care most about is the politics, being able to boast to your base that you've succeeded in repealing Obamacare, while making sure that you can get reelected in the midterms before the rest of the country figures out how devastating repeal would be. And even then, they still have to come up with a plan. But if it doesn't cover people with pre-existing conditions, guarantee that people won't go bankrupt if they get sick, and continue to bend the cost curve, then it isn't replacement at all. In fact, President Trump has gone on record promising that Republican replacement will cover every American, give them the same or better benefits, and cost less. I'm all ears. The truth is, I don't really believe that the Republicans are ever going to come up with a real replacement for the Affordable Care Act, because it seems to me that they don't actually care about making sure that every American has access to quality, affordable health care. What do they care about? They want insurance companies to be able to sell you junk policies. They want drug manufacturers to be able to gouge people who rely on medications to stay healthy. They want to make it harder for people who've suffered from medical malpractice to get their day in court. They want rich people to not have to pay for health care for poor people. And most of all, they want to keep using this issue to rally their base, reward their donors, and punish Democrats. I don't know what's going to happen going forward. Heck, I don't even know what's going to happen between the time I finish this book and the time you listen to it. But what I do know is this. Anyone who trusts this Republican Party with the future of our nation's health care system simply hasn't been paying attention. Chapter 34. I Meet George W. Bush. Hey, how about a palate cleanser? Here's an interesting story, or at least a story at any rate. In the spring of 2015, I was invited to a Major League Baseball dinner at the Hay Adams Hotel right across the street from the White House. Dinners in D.C. are an enormous time suck, so I try to avoid them if I possibly can. But a number of the team owners, including Jim Polad of the Minnesota Twins, were going to be there, so I accepted the invitation to sit at his table. Mitch McConnell and Speaker Boehner came as well because the owner of the Cincinnati Reds was there, and Dianne Feinstein was seated with the owner of the San Francisco Giants. It was a nice evening, about 50 people. After cocktails and dinner, the new commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred, welcomed everybody. Mitch and John Boehner gave nice remarks about being lifelong Reds fans. Boehner's from Cincinnati, and Mitch's hometown, Louisville, Kentucky, is right down the Ohio River from, well, Riverfront Stadium, where the Big Red Machine dominated the National League during most of the 1970s. And then Dianne got up to the podium to talk about the importance of the Giants to San Francisco. As I listened to Dianne, I noticed a slight change in the sound of the room. I turned around and saw former President George W. Bush and his wife Laura standing at the back, smiling. Dianne acknowledged the president and Laura and wrapped up. Then the new commissioner invited the former Texas Rangers owner and commander-in-chief to make a few remarks. As Bush walked up to the podium, we all gave him a standing ovation. I thought he was a terrible president, but he had been the president, and I wanted to show respect for his office. He seemed really loose and happy and started with a joke. "Usually I do this for money." Good laugh. "I hope Bill and Hillary don't ruin it for me." Big laugh. He was referring, of course, to the recent headlines about the crap loads of money the Clintons had been raking in for public speaking gigs. Funny and topical. Not bad. He spoke for 5 minutes, another standing ovation. I said my goodnights to the folks at my table and made my exit, heading toward the door farthest from the podium in order to avoid running into the former president, whom I had savaged to great comedic and commercial success. But as I turned around and headed in that direction, I suddenly saw him standing directly between me and the exit, engaged in a conversation with two people I also didn't want to talk to. I couldn't very well skirt past the former president without it seeming like I was snubbing him, so I stopped and stood awkwardly, respectfully, a few feet away. Bush saw me and suddenly made a beeline right toward me. "Remember where we were the last time we saw each other?" he asked. Yeah, I said, "Iowa." I had been covering the Iowa straw poll for George Magazine in August 1999 and met Bush at a small event in someone's backyard in Indianola. "Do you remember what I asked you?" I asked him. "No." "Okay. It was when the cocaine stuff was coming out, and I said I wasn't interested in that, but since we were in Iowa, I wanted to ask whether you had ever manufactured any crystal meth." He nodded, perhaps wondering where I was going with this. "And you outsmarted me," I continued. Now he had it. I didn't answer, did I? "No, and that was smart, because if you had, I would have said, then why won't you answer the cocaine question?" He nodded. I decided to change the subject. "You know what I always liked about you is that you like comedy." "I do," he confirmed enthusiastically. "I remember you said that your favorite movie was Austin Powers." "Still is." "And I remember you're taking a risk by going on Letterman via satellite." He remembered that. "That was a mistake." "Staff error, sir." I could tell he appreciated that. I continued. "And you told a very risky joke that I admired you for, because I can't imagine anyone on your team thought it was a good idea. Do you remember it?"
"No."
"Well," I said, "Dave asked you, you say you're a uniter, not a divider. What does that mean? And you said via satellite, well, if you had open heart surgery, I'd sew you back up." Now, this had been just a few months after Dave had open heart surgery.
And that got a big laugh, right?
No. See, you were on satellite and you didn't see it, but Dave turned to the audience and completely sold you out. I'm not sure he understood that I was giving him a compliment for taking the risk rather than reveling in how badly he had bombed, but in either case, he came back with an upbeat comment. Well, you were always my favorite comedian on Saturday Night Live. I made a face clearly indicating that I wasn't buying that for a moment. Okay, he said with a big grin. I was lying. Well, I responded, you're my favorite president. He laughed and gave me a big high five. Holy mackerel, I liked him. Now I understood how he got elected twice. Or once, if you're one of the people who constantly call in to Air America. Chapter 35. The 64% Rule. In order to be an effective Democratic senator, you have to be able to hold two inherently contradictory ideas in your head at the same time without suffering a cerebral hemorrhage. One, Republicans are just awful. They're beholden to corporate special interests. They're dishonest and or crazy. They're so cynical that they willingly thwart badly needed programs for the sake of their own selfish political motivations. And they've broken Washington irrevocably. So if we care about making progress in America, we need to fight them at every turn. Two, Republicans exist. And they care about our country just as much as we do, if not always exactly in the same way we do. We do not have a monopoly on power. How's that for an understatement? And the truth is, neither do we have a monopoly on good ideas. So if we care about making progress in America, we need to work with them. My friend Mike Enzi, a Republican senator from Wyoming, has what he calls the 80% rule. Republicans and Democrats, Mike says, actually agree on 80% of any given piece of legislation. So if we focus on that 80% and ignore the 20% where we disagree, we can get a lot done. I think Mike may be a little too optimistic. Some issues, there's just no common ground. If some of us believe that you should be allowed to bring military-style assault weapons onto public transportation, and others of us think that's insane, there's no 80% there. We just have to argue about it and then take a vote and live with the outcome, at least until we win some more elections. Mike's 80% rule, in my estimation, only applies charitably to about 80% of what we do in the Senate. Hence, Franken's 64% rule. The good news is that there's a lot you can get done in that 64%. Take one of the issues where we have actually made some bipartisan progress during my time in the Senate. Education. Everyone agrees that there's nothing more fundamental to our nation's success than education. 100% of politicians say that 100% of the time. Now, there are some basic fault lines between Democrats and Republicans on this issue. Generally speaking, Democrats support teachers' unions, public school systems, and a strong federal role in education, while Republicans believe in more local control of education and believe that competition in the form of school vouchers will improve the quality of schools. Also, some conservatives used to secretly support the voucher movement because they wanted to undermine public education in order to advance God's kingdom by diverting funding from public schools to religious schools. I say used to because with Betsy DeVos now running the Department of Education, they no longer bother keeping it a secret. Anyway, those fault lines were scrambled in 2002. When George W. Bush signed into law his signature education bill, called with unintended irony, No Child Left Behind, NCLB. Passed with strong bipartisan support, NCLB sought to improve our nation's K-12 education system by setting high standards and imposing an extensive testing regime on public elementary and secondary schools, along with draconian measures if the schools failed to achieve federally mandated progress. By the time I came to the Senate, there was a bipartisan consensus that NCLB was a disaster. During my 2008 campaign, I'd often say in my stump speech, I have not met one teacher in Minnesota who likes No Child Left Behind. Then in early October, a teacher took me aside. I like No Child Left Behind, he said quietly, because it disaggregates the data. Under NCLB, test data was broken down, and each subgroup of students at a school, Black, Hispanic, American Indian, English language learners, students in special education, had to succeed in order for the school to be considered to have made adequate yearly progress. The teacher continued, that guarantees that schools are finally interested in how their Black and Hispanic kids are doing. And he was absolutely right. You see, NCLB was a reauthorization of the original Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESEA, signed into law by President Johnson. And like the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which made my dad and me Democrats, and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, ESEA was a civil rights bill, giving the federal government a bigger role in K-12 education to ensure the states were providing a decent education for all of their students. So the disaggregation of data became the second thing I liked about No Child Left Behind, the first being the name. Otherwise, the law was a disaster. If a school failed to make adequate yearly progress for 4 years in a row, it would have to undergo a federally mandated restructuring. In some cases, schools would be forced to fire and replace 50% of their teachers and their principal. This made no sense, for example, in rural areas where there are teacher shortages. A number of rural school superintendents told me about two failing schools in their district, which just swapped their principals and half their teachers, showing the sort of problem-solving ingenuity that I dearly hope they passed on to their students. NCLB had a whole host of wildly stupid rules. For example, students would take their NCLB tests in late April, which meant that the school wouldn't get the results until well after the school year had ended, at which point it was too late to use the results to actually help the students. Hence, educators referred to the test results as autopsies. Another stupid thing. Schools were judged by what percentage of students met or exceeded proficiency. That created a perverse incentive for teachers to focus on kids in the middle, students right below and right above this arbitrary proficiency benchmark. Teachers in Minnesota called this a race to the middle. They could ignore the kids at the top because they knew those kids would never fall below proficiency. And they could ignore the kids at the bottom because there was almost no chance that those students would reach proficiency that school year. This proficiency thing was nuts. A sixth grade teacher who takes a kid from a third grade level of reading to a fifth grade level of reading is a hero, not a failure. More stupidly, the tests were not allowed to measure students' ability outside their grade level. A fifth grader could only take a test designed to show whether or not he could read at a fifth grade level. If your son couldn't read at a fifth grade level, wouldn't you want to know whether he was reading at a fourth grade level as opposed to a second grade level? Tough. The NCLB test didn't do that. It only measured for fifth grade proficiency and gave no answer more detailed than pass or fail. That's why many Minnesota schools started administering a computer adaptive test in addition to the mandated NCLB test. These tests were far more useful. For one thing, they were on a computer, meaning teachers could get the results for each kid right away and use them to inform their instruction. For another, they were adaptive, meaning that if a kid was answering questions correctly, the questions would get harder and vice versa. That way, the teachers could see at exactly what grade level each student was testing. Teachers, principals, and superintendents in Minnesota all told me they preferred the computer adaptive test. But this meant that students had to take both tests. And because the stakes were so high, that meant a lot of test prep, or what teachers referred to as drill and kill. It reminded me of the McNamara fallacy, Named for Robert McNamara, Kennedy and Johnson's data-driven Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. The McNamara fallacy is this: what can be measured will be measured, and what cannot be measured won't be measured, and only things that are measured are deemed important. Hence the drilling and killing. Teachers spent all their time trying to get their kids to learn certain discrete skills that they knew would be tested. Not on the test, and therefore not in the lesson plans, were things like critical thinking, creativity, the ability to work with others, and love of learning. All of which are kind of important, or at least I'm told, you know, by employers. By the time I got to the Senate, everyone knew that NCLB needed to be reformed. We held lots of hearings and talked to lots of witnesses. There was a lot of agreement on what wasn't working, and we all took turns vehemently agreeing about it. In other words, we did a lot of what we in Washington call admiring the problem. So why did it take 7 years to get it done? Well, that whole two contradictory ideas thing works both ways. Even as we were finding ourselves in agreement on what we needed to do, Republican leaders were working to prevent us from actually doing it. The entire time Democrats held the majority in the Senate, we couldn't break through to even bring a K-12 education bill to the floor. But after Republicans took the majority in the 2014 election, we started to see some things move. Ironic, you might think, but not really. As Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell's goal was almost always to stop Obama and Senate Democrats from getting things done, to prevent us from having achievements we could point to. But Obama wouldn't be on the ballot in 2016, and McConnell was suddenly interested in getting some things done so that his majority could have something to show for itself. But hey, after 6 years, Democrats were willing, hell eager, to go along with it. We believe in government, after all, and even if it meant Republicans got a lot of the credit, we were happy to be moving forward on long-delayed priorities like a 5-year highway bill and, at long last, education reform. At the outset, Republican Help Committee Chairman Lamar Alexander put together a totally partisan Republican bill, which ranking Democrat Patty Murray and the rest of us refused to take up. After that initial exchange, Lamar and Patty got down to business, working together on a truly bipartisan bill in an exemplary way. I have tremendous admiration for Lamar Alexander. Time and again, he'd call a hearing, and the night before, I'd read through the testimony of the next day's witnesses, only to discover that one after another was planning to say something that I knew Lamar didn't agree with. In other words, he was willing to call witnesses who offered opposing views, and he always listened carefully. That, by the way, is why I was so disappointed when he took one for the team by cutting off questions after one round during the confirmation hearings for Trump nominees Betsy DeVos and Tom Price. I assume because the questions were revealing that DeVos didn't know the first thing about public education and that Price had a long history of suspicious stock purchases. More on those hearings later. The bill we passed in 2015 represented the 80% or 64% that Senate Republicans and Democrats finally realized we agreed on. Schools would still have to test every year between 3rd and 8th grade and once in high school. But each state would control its own testing, and that would almost certainly mean fewer high-stakes tests. Meanwhile, we would invest more in early childhood education, which Democrats liked, but not enough, which Republicans liked. But everyone got to say we had done something about early childhood education, which everyone liked, because the impact is so clear. Inequality in education starts early, and it starts at home. A study by the University of Kansas found that by the time she is 3 years old, a child who grows up in a home on welfare will hear 30 million fewer words than a child who grows up in the home of a professional family. Words like portfolio and equestrian. Actually, that's not 30 million distinctly different words. I don't think there are 30 million words. During the study, researchers found that children from welfare families heard on average about 600 words an hour. Children from professional families her 2,100 words an hour. We know that kids who have had quality early childhood education are less likely to be placed in special education, less likely to be left back a grade, more likely to have better health outcomes, less likely to get pregnant in adolescence, more likely to graduate from high school, more likely to go to college, more likely to get a good job, and less likely to go to prison. The return on investment in quality early childhood education can be as high as $16 for every dollar spent. If we really wanted to address future deficits, we would be pouring money into training early childhood educators. Didn't happen here, though. The law we passed put more funding into after-school programs, more funding into school counselors, more funding for mental health in schools, although not enough of any of it. There's also more, but not enough funding for STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, and math, which are necessary for so many 21st century jobs. When I think about after-school programs and STEM skills, I don't just think of the academic literature on school achievement. I think of FIRST Robotics. In FIRST Robotics, high school teams build and program robots to compete against other schools in a complex game, which changes every year, like hitting a target with a frisbee and climbing a jungle gym. Believe it or not, there are now more high school FIRST Robotics teams in Minnesota than boys' varsity hockey teams. When the team from East Duluth finished 10th in the world championships a few years ago, I went up to highlight their achievement at an auto body shop where they were building their new robot. The fabrication co-captain, a sophomore named Anna Karras, introduced me to the programming co-captain, the business co-captain, and the media co-captain. Then Anna did an interview with the three Duluth camera crews that showed up for the event. "What does it mean to you that three cameras are here today?" one of the producers asked. "It's very in line with our media strategy," Anna answered. "I don't worry about Anna. With millions of self-replicating, tireless robots as her obedient slaves, there's almost no limit to what she can accomplish in the future." A number of my amendments didn't make it into the bill. Take, for example, my Student Non-Discrimination Act. SENDA would give LGBT students the same rights that students have on the basis of race, disability, and gender, including the private right of action, the right to sue. There has been an epidemic of bullying of LGBT students across the country. Many LGBT kids have committed suicide. 30% of LGBT students report missing a day of school in the last month because they're afraid. For years, I tried and failed to get a Republican co-sponsor. One night, I called a good Republican friend of mine. Me. My amendment gives LGBT kids and their parents a private right of action. My colleague. "Well, the kids will just act more gay so they can sue." Me. "Oh, no, no, no. That's not what would happen. You just watch." Me, silently. "Aye." But there's one amendment that I did get through that I am as proud of as anything I've done in the Senate. It's not uncommon for foster children to have 10, 11, 12 sets of foster parents during their childhood. This wreaks havoc on their education. If a child's new foster parents live in a different school district, the foster child is yanked out of school and sent to one in the new school district. Sometimes the kids fall through the cracks. Kayla Van Dyke, an impressive high school senior from Minnesota who has been in 7 foster homes, testified to the HELP committee that she had missed 4th grade entirely. For foster kids, school is often the one constant in their lives. Maybe they have a teacher they really like, or an extracurricular activity that means everything to them. Or maybe they have these things called friends. My amendment was simple. It allowed foster kids to choose to stay in their school if they wanted to. That meant the school district and local social services would have to find a way to pay for their transportation. At first, almost all of my Republican colleagues were against it. After all, it was a federal mandate. requiring local school districts to spend money. But after 6 years of talking to my colleagues one-on-one, they had come to see the wisdom of my proposal. The amendment passed overwhelmingly and became part of the new law. I like to think that somewhere there's a foster child running cross-country or developing a passion for history because of a great teacher, or doing homework with a good friend, because of the legislation I worked hard on. Legislation that passed with a strong bipartisan majority. And my fervent hope is that kid will grow up to run for the Senate as a Democrat and knock off a Republican incumbent. If we want to help kids, especially kids who don't have all the advantages that I had and that my kids had and that my grandkids are going to have, then one education bill isn't going to do it. And just focusing on education itself isn't enough. For example, kids who grow up poor are far more likely to suffer what are called adverse childhood experiences. Not just the stress of living in poverty itself, but domestic violence, abuse or neglect, the incarceration of a parent, the death of a sibling, all of which affect brain chemistry and the ability to learn. If we want to improve education, we need to do a better job of helping these kids overcome these traumas and a better job of addressing economic inequality so that fewer have to deal with trauma in the first place. Which means we need to create more prosperity and do it in a way where everybody gets to prosper. Which means we need to invest in our infrastructure and in research and development and in innovative technologies and in our workforce. And most of all, in our kids. Which would be a hell of a lot easier if our political system wasn't broken. It's going to be hard to unbreak it as long as Republicans continue to hold a lot of power. It would be great if someday soon we had a Democratic president and a Democratic House and a filibuster-proof Democratic majority in the Senate, or really any of those things. And a huge part of what all of us have to do from here on out is to fight back to win back the country, up and down the ballot. We have to organize from the grassroots on up. We have to make our case to the public, and we have to go on offense. But in the meantime, on Capitol Hill, I still believe that the 64% rule applies. Just because we're out of power doesn't mean we abdicate our responsibility to try to improve people's lives. That's what makes us Democrats. It's what makes us worth electing in the first place. Of course, now that Donald Trump is president, even 64% might be a little optimistic. I figure we're going to spend some portion of our time trying to stop him from giving Alaska back to the Russians. Let's say we spend 60% of our time on stuff like that instead of making progress. Doing the math, that means we're down to, 64% times the remaining 40%. Okay, 25.6%. But I'm an optimist, so let's round up, 26%. And, of course, our new Secretary of Education is a right-wing ideologue who hates public schools, so maybe education isn't going to be in that 26% for a while, but something else will be. I can't think of anything right now. ISIS? Opioids? Cybersecurity? Sentencing reform? Maybe that Victor Borges stamp from a couple chapters ago. There's plenty to choose from. Chapter 36, My Republican Friends. Okay, maybe 26% is a little high. Maybe it's more like 20% or 15, or maybe you're just a total pessimist and you think it's closer to 2%. But even if 98% of the time we're at an impasse, there's progress to be made in that 2%. Remember how my dad's quilting factory failed because the railroad wouldn't stop in Albert Lea to pick up his goods to bring to market? That's an example of something called captive shipping. In much of America, railroads enjoy a monopoly and are able to charge farmers and manufacturers exorbitant prices to carry their products. If you don't pay, the railroad doesn't stop, and you have to move to St. Louis Park to become a printing salesman. The Surface Transportation Board, STB, has jurisdiction over railroads. And just as George W. Bush invaded Iraq to avenge his own father, I wanted to make it easier for someone who had been the victim of captive shipping to do something about it. When I first got to the Senate, it cost $20,000 to lodge a complaint with the STB. If you're a small farmer watching freight trains zip through your community without stopping because you can't afford to pay the monopoly prices to the railroad, you tend not to have $20,000 lying around. I wanted to put pressure on the STB to lower the fee for lodging a complaint. But as is almost always the case, the odds of success were going to be far higher if I had a Republican partner, which is how I ended up working with David Vitter, an extremely conservative Republican with whom I almost never agreed and whose personal conduct I was repulsed by. Google it. Together, David and I got the STB to lower the fee to $350. And then we went back to voting against each other pretty much all the time. I've worked with John Bozeman from Arkansas on improving health care for veterans. I've worked with Deb Fisher from Nebraska on increasing access to rural broadband. I've worked with Bill Cassidy from Louisiana on addiction issues. I'm working right now with Tom Tillis from North Carolina on funding housing and wraparound services for people with mental illness. They're all extremely conservative Republicans who, I'm sure, don't want me to say anything good about them. And make no mistake, I hope they all get beat in their next elections. But they're there right now. And just as part of my job is standing my ground against all the terrible things they want to do, part of it is looking for opportunities to find common ground, because that's how stuff gets done. You see, there are only 100 of us senators, and none of us can do the job without working with the other 99. Mike Mansfield had a saying, "It only takes one senator to make a scene, but it takes more than one to make a difference." Okay, he never said that. I made it up. But if he had, it certainly would have made my point, which is that, sure, a lone senator can hold things up with a filibuster or some other procedural maneuver, but actually passing legislation takes teamwork. Very often, the only way a bill stands a chance is if you can find a co-sponsor in the other party to make it bipartisan. Sometimes you have a regional issue that requires you to cooperate with colleagues from neighboring states, even if you and said colleagues don't see eye to eye on pretty much anything else. For example, there's a history of flooding in the Red River Valley between Minnesota and North Dakota, so it's really important that North Dakota Republican John Hoeven and I be able to work together to fight for flood mitigation funding. That's why we have all these unwritten rules, like addressing each other as my esteemed colleague, even when we may, in fact, esteem each other very little. It's why you're not supposed to smirk or roll your eyes when someone else is giving a speech on the floor and you're presiding. That would be a real jerk move. It's why, as silly as it may sound, it's important that we try to like each other. That's right, like each other. Not just the Lamar Alexander types either. In my view, you've got to build friendships with the Jeff Sessions types too. Like, for example, with Jeff Sessions. When I first got to the Senate, Jeff was the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, and I made it a point to go to every hearing, no matter how perfunctory. Often we'd have a nomination hearing for a judge whose confirmation was completely non-controversial. And it would just be the chairman, Patrick Leahy, Jeff, and me. I wasn't just there because I had nothing else to do. I was there to prove that I had come to the Senate to work, not be a clown. And Jeff took notice. He saw me show up for every hearing. He heard me take the responsibility of questioning the nominees seriously. And even though he probably agreed with literally nothing I said, he quickly grew to like the cut of my jib. A few weeks in, Chairman Leahy had to miss a hearing, so he asked me to fill in. I arrived early, and when Jeff got there, he saw me sitting in the chairman's seat, holding the gavel. "Well," exclaimed Jeff in his thick southern drawl, a meteoric rise. And well-deserved, I replied in my nasal Midwestern Jewish twang. Jeff laughed. He's been an easy laugh for me ever since, except at his confirmation hearing. Anyway, the point is, Jeff liked me, and here's why I like him. A few years later, the Judiciary Committee was holding a hearing on a Dianne Feinstein bill to protect American citizens apprehended within the United States on terrorism charges from being detained indefinitely without a trial. One of the witnesses was Stephen Bradbury, a lawyer who had written one of the Bush administration memos inventing some flimsy legal rationale for torture, thus contributing to the decline of our reputation on the world stage, inflaming anti-American sentiment in the Middle East, and putting our troops in more danger. I wasn't really interested in hearing this guy's thoughts on due process, and I told him so. It's very difficult for me, frankly, to rely on your legal opinion today, I said, suggesting that someone with his record had no business testifying before the committee. It was pretty aggressive by Senate committee standards, so aggressive, in fact, that my questioning really offended some of the Republicans on the committee. But I didn't know that until Jeff was kind enough to call me and give me a heads up that I should probably cool it for a little while. It was a real act of friendship. I had had no idea that I was digging myself such a hole with my colleagues by teeing off on this ghoul, and I really appreciated that Jeff was gracious enough to clue me in so I could back off just a bit. When Trump won the election and nominated Jeff to be Attorney General, it was time for me to return the favor by setting aside my very real concerns about his record and the Trump administration's plans for the Department of Justice and just waving his nomination through. No, of course not. Being a senator does mean finding a way to make friends with people you're fighting against with every fiber of your being. But it also means finding a way to fight with every fiber of your being against people you're friends with. I rarely voted with Jeff when he was a senator, and that's fine. Senators disagree. But I knew that as Attorney General, he would represent a clear and present danger to the civil rights of millions of Americans. And his confirmation hearing would be my opportunity to raise that alarm, which I did without apology, calling him out for overstating his involvement in civil rights cases and holding his feet to the fire on Donald Trump's fear-mongering about voter fraud, which, of course, is nothing more than a pretext for voter suppression. And then I voted against him. Jeff Sessions is my friend, or was. Franny is friends with his wife, Mary. When our grandson Joe was born, Mary knit him a baby blue blanket, which became his favorite. It's hard to unfairly demonize someone whose wife knit your grandson his favorite blankie, which is why when my job meant doing everything in my power to deny my friend this important position, I was relieved that there was so much to fairly demonize him for. For my part, I've tried to create more opportunities for us senators to be nice to each other. For example, at any given time, we have 30 or so pages working in the Senate. Pages are high school juniors, 16-year-old kids, who come to Washington to spend months helping out with day-to-day operations in the Senate chamber. They all live together in a dorm, and if I were a parent of one of them, I realized, I would want to know that senators were keeping an eye out for them and helping them to have a positive experience. So, Franny and I teamed up with Mike and Diana Enzi to start a tradition of throwing pizza parties and ice cream socials for these kids. Pages are generally not allowed to initiate conversations with senators, so Mike and I give them an opportunity to ask us questions like, is being a senator as much fun as being on Saturday Night Live? Or in Mike's case, is being a senator as much fun as being an accountant? Another initiative I spearheaded over the repeated and grumpy objections of Harry Reid was our annual Senate Secret Santa. I modeled it after the Secret Santa we had back in elementary school in St. Louis Park. The idea was that every kid would get a gift, but also that every kid would have to learn something about someone they maybe didn't know and do a nice thing for them. I figured it would be a fun, bipartisan thing for us to do, and because every senator who participated would get a present, no senator would get his or her feelings hurt. One year, though, Jeff Flake, an iconoclastic Republican from Arizona, kind of hurt my feelings by giving me a crappy present. A hat bearing the logo of Ping, which apparently is a golf equipment company based in his home state. I complained about it to Tim Kaine. Flake gave me this stupid hat. This is the worst Secret Santa gift ever. What was he thinking? Staff error, said Tim. He's really smart and would make a great vice president. God damn it. Now I'm depressed. Let's move on. Not surprisingly, the quickest way to my heart is through my funny bone, which isn't the elbow, but rather the rib that lies directly over the heart. Aw. And my favorite Republican colleagues aren't the ones whose politics are the least objectionable, but rather the ones with the best senses of humor, no matter how objectionable their politics may be. Pat Roberts has got to be near the top of that list. As I mentioned earlier, he loves Bob and Ray, but he loves Jack Benny even more, and he has a little bit of that famous Jack Benny comic timing. When I see him in an elevator or in the Senate subway, I usually greet him with a, "May I help you?" in the annoying voice of character actor Frank Nelson, a regular on the old Jack Benny program. Pat replies with a great Benny-esque, "You again." And then we laugh. No one within earshot has a clue what we're laughing about, and odds are neither do you, but we don't care. And though our politics couldn't be more different, we always jump at the chance to work on something together. For example, the regulations on drug compounding, which is when pharmacists mix prescriptions themselves from individual ingredients. Well, they were very confusing, and in 2012, 800 Americans contracted fungal meningitis, and 64 died due to unsafe drugs that shouldn't have been allowed to be distributed. Pat and I discovered that we both wanted to work on this issue, so we teamed up and closed the loopholes. Then there was a time I needed Republican votes for an amendment to get $11 million for energy projects in Indian country, so I asked Pat. He stood with me in the well of the Senate, doing his best to urge his Republican colleagues to help me. And by his best, I mean that Pat told them, "Leadership describes this as completely innocuous." I got the votes. Pat's funny, but the funniest Republican in the Senate is Lindsey Graham. Most of his jokes are of the "we're in a cynical business" variety. For example, before our Christmas break one year, Lindsey asked me if the Frankens were going anywhere for some sun. I told him we were going to Puerto Rico. Without missing a beat, Lindsey gave me some advice. Do two fundraisers, one with the folks for statehood, one with the folks against statehood. They never talk to each other. In 2016, Lindsey ran for president and found himself somewhere around 15 in a field of 17. Running into him in the senator's bathroom, I told him, "Lindsey, if I were voting in the Republican primaries, I'd vote for you." Again, without hesitation, he replied, "That's my problem." Believe it or not, however, not every senator has a great sense of humor. Tom Coburn and I did not hit it off right away. A terrifyingly conservative Republican from Oklahoma, he was known as Dr. No. For two reasons. First, Tom's an obstetrician-gynecologist. Second, he is an adamant federalist who believes the federal government has appropriated too much power from the states, which means he's pretty much opposed to Congress doing anything. But that's not why we didn't hit it off. Our first four or five interactions were just misses. Nothing terrible. Mainly, he just didn't seem to get where I was coming from. So I approached him at a Judiciary Committee hearing to take another shot at breaking the ice. "Tom, can I buy you lunch?" "Tell you what," he said. Buy me breakfast. We sat down together a couple days later in the Senate dining room around 8 a.m. I had given some thought to how I wanted to start. Tom, I said cheerily, let's have fun. We can talk about anything, politics, our families, our careers, but let's make sure to have fun. Sure, he nodded. Fun. Okay, I said, careers. Let me ask you something. To be a doctor in Oklahoma, do you have to have any formal education? Yes, he exploded angrily. You have to go to medical school. Ah, I had identified our problem. Okay, I explained. That was a joke. Tom understood immediately and calmed right down. You see, that's what I used to do for a living. I told jokes. I was in comedy. We did have fun for the next 45 minutes, and he wrote me a lovely note thanking me for breakfast and for the fun, which seemed like it had been a novel experience for him. Tom retired from the Senate after 2014 with a nearly perfect record of voting against everything I like. But when I called Tom a few months ago to make sure it was okay with him if I told this story, he agreed right away. You're a gentleman to ask, but there's a First Amendment. You can write anything you want. It was very Tom Coburn. Then we had some fun talking about grandchildren. I should note, I like my Democratic colleagues too, but I spend a lot more time with them and we agree on stuff, so it's easy to like them. It's harder to make friends across the aisle. And it's also more important. It's a lot easier to negotiate with people you trust and whom you don't personally dislike. And that's why you fight as hard as you can for your principles, but try not to be a jerk about it. It's why it's important that your word is good. It's why it's important to try to build these relationships with colleagues across the aisle, whether it's through family bonding or inside jokes or writing a country song together, which I did with Orrin Hatch. It's called We Stayed Together for the Kids, and I needed a bridge. When Orrin and I were working on it in his office, Orrin's scheduler called my scheduler and said, I don't know what's going on in there, they're just laughing. And the song kind of went like this. We stayed together for the kids. It was what we thought we had to do. But now the kids are up and gone, and there's just me and there's just you. That wasn't the bridge. Unfortunately, building those bonds is harder now than it used to be. For one thing, members of Congress used to bring their families to Washington to live. Members would see each other on weekends or just hang out. Their kids used to go to school together in D.C. or suburban Maryland or Virginia. It's hard to hate the parent of a kid who's on your kid's baseball team. To a great degree, the 1994 election changed that. Newt Gingrich told Republicans to run against Washington. They did, and they won. He told them to keep their families in their home districts, and they did. And for some of them, it put pressure on their family life. Newt, for example. But mostly, it meant that members would fly into D.C. on Monday afternoon and fly out on Thursday afternoon, a practice that has continued to this day. Meanwhile, our schedules have got more packed than ever. Every minute we don't spend fulfilling the requirements of our jobs, we're expected to spend raising money, and we're also expected to spend as much time as possible in our states, which doesn't leave a lot of time for getting to know and therefore trust your colleagues. At the end of the day, the Senate is like any other workplace. You don't always enjoy all of your coworkers, but you're far better off finding a way to get along with them than you are harping on the things you don't like. And being a successful senator is as much about being a good coworker as it is about being smart or well-versed in the issues or a talented orator. If you can be a pleasure to work with, you'll get more accomplished than if you're a pill whom no one can stand. Which brings me to Ted Cruz. Chapter 37, Sophistry. As I mentioned in the last chapter, there are unwritten rules of the Senate that everyone follows in order to maintain civility and foster productive working relationships. One of those unwritten rules is that you aren't supposed to repeat in public a conversation you've had with a colleague in private if that conversation makes your colleague look bad in any way. I've decided to observe that practice in this book with one exception, Ted Cruz. For what it's worth, I feel fully justified in doing so because Ted violated basic Senate protocol himself when he went to the floor and called Mitch McConnell a liar. It was the sort of thing that just isn't done, a breach of decorum so shocking that even I haven't committed it, and I love calling people liars. Anyway, here's the thing you have to understand about Ted Cruz. I like Ted Cruz more than most of my other colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz. The reason I like Ted more than most of my other colleagues do is that he actually has a decent sense of humor. Ted has tried out jokes on me. They're usually pretty pedestrian, usually I can see the punchline coming, and many are not very good versions of constructions I've heard before. But as politician jokes go, they're not bad at all. And Ted is a fan of comedy, I think. You're never entirely sure with this guy. One Monday, after a week's recess, Ted came up to me on the floor to tell me that he and some friends had watched a rerun of my Stuart Smalley sketch with Michael Jordan and raved about how funny it was. I think he was being sincere, which meant it was a genuinely nice gesture. The only problem was that at that moment I was talking to my friend Jeff Sessions about our respective recesses, and now I had to try to explain to Jeff what Ted was talking about, which meant I had to explain what recovery is, what affirmations are, what public access TV is, what a parody of public access TV is, and I had to do it all in about 30 seconds before Jeff lost interest, which of course I failed to do, and Jeff just kind of faded away to talk with someone else. Great. Anyway, Ted has a sense of humor, even if it's a lame one. And he did pay me a modest compliment, even if it was some Machiavellian ploy in service of his ambition to take over the world. The problem with Ted isn't that he's humorless. It isn't even his truly reprehensible far-right politics. No, the problem with Ted, and the reason so many senators have a problem with Ted, is simply that he's an absolutely toxic coworker. He's the guy in your office who snitches to corporate about your March Madness pool and microwaves fish in the office kitchen. He is the Dwight Schrute of the Senate. In a way, he's a perfect example of what I said in the last chapter about how it's not your knowledge of policy or your political talents, but rather your people skills that determine whether you succeed as a senator. For sure, Ted is extremely smart. Only the most brilliant young lawyers get to clerk for Supreme Court justices, and Ted got to clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist. And he's a truly gifted speaker who can frame an argument brilliantly. From what I've heard, when Cruz later returned to the court to argue cases in his capacity as Solicitor General of Texas, clerks would all make a point to be present in the chamber so they could watch him do his thing. I don't begrudge Ted that. There are plenty of senators who are smarter than I am or have more natural political aptitude than I do. For example, my own senior senator, Amy Klobuchar, or my friend Sheldon Whitehouse, one of the smartest people I've ever met, or Lindsey Graham. But I like them all, because none of them are sociopaths. Let me explain by telling you what I consider to be the quintessential Ted Cruz story. After the unspeakable mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, Dianne Feinstein introduced a bill to reinstate the federal assault weapons ban, which was enacted in 1994 and expired in 2004. Now, there are plenty of things we could be doing to address gun violence that are overwhelmingly popular and aren't getting done only because Republicans have decided to refuse to do anything on guns, such as closing the loophole that allows people to buy guns at gun shows or on some websites without a background check. But there is a little more room for disagreement when it comes to the assault weapons ban. I, for one, wanted to co-sponsor Dianne's bill right away, But we have a very strong gun culture in Minnesota, and my advisors in the state urge caution. Why be in such a rush to back the bill? How am I going to feel when this happens again? I asked. But I understood why many of my constituents felt differently. I love football. There's no reason to love football as much as I love football, but people live for their pastimes. And one popular pastime, especially in Minnesota, is target shooting with AR-15s. Who am I to say that that's any more or less valid of a hobby than watching football players give each other concussions? Anyway, I wanted to treat the debate with the seriousness it deserved, so even though I decided to support the assault weapons ban, I made sure to listen to both sides. I even visited a gun manufacturer in St. Cloud where they made AR-15s. It's actually a great company. They have a terrific record of hiring veterans, but they are very much central casting pro-gun guys. The company doesn't make ammunition clips, just the AR-15s themselves, so I decided to start with something I thought we could maybe agree on. I asked why anyone would need a 30-round magazine to go hunting, and the manager shook his head and said, "If anyone needs 10 bullets to take down a deer..." It seemed like we were finding some common ground, so why, I asked, would anyone need an assault rifle to go hunting at all? And one of the guys brought up feral pigs. Apparently they run in packs, and they're vicious. We don't have a lot of feral pigs in Minnesota, but they're evidently a real problem in parts of the South. "Has anyone ever been killed by a feral pig?" I asked. There was an awkward pause. Then someone said, "I heard of a guy who got bit in the leg." That didn't really seem like a reason to tote around an AR-15 with a 30-round magazine, but I didn't want to push my luck, so I asked, "Well, are they good eating, the feral pigs?" And one of the guys said, "If they're young." Okay, that wasn't a story about Ted Cruz, but it was a story about how fraught the debate was over the assault weapons ban and how I tried hard to take that debate seriously. And also, you learned something I bet you didn't know, which is that if you're going to eat a feral pig, you should eat a young one. Now, here's where Ted comes into the story. Back in Washington, Ted was taking absolutely no pains to listen to the other side. Instead, he was vehemently and theatrically opposing the bill with a series of fiery sermons on the Senate floor. And then one day he came up to me during a vote and said the following: "Anyone who's for the assault weapons ban is engaged in sophistry." Sophistry is an SAT word, one that I had neither seen nor heard nor spoken since I was 16 years old. Our English teacher, Mr. Glenn, had assigned us a vocabulary book, and we were to learn 3 words a day. And one day, sophistry was one of the words. Sophistry is a form of argument that is intended to be deceitful. I don't think Ted knew that I was a co-sponsor of Diane's bill. I also don't think he knew that I knew what sophistry meant, which I think is why he used the word. But I played along. Why am I engaged in sophistry? Because, Ted said, Clinton's own Department of Justice did a study of the assault weapons ban and concluded that it doesn't work. "No, it didn't," I replied. "Actually, what the report said was that there wasn't enough data to reach a conclusion because the study was conducted only 2 years after the ban was implemented." "Just read the report," Ted sneered in his pugnacious way. I think pugnacious was also one of Mr. Glenn's vocabulary words. "I'll do that," I said with an edge of, truculence. After the vote, I took the Senate subway to my office and found Josh Riley, my judiciary counsel. "Ted Cruz just told me that anyone who's for the assault weapons ban is engaged in sophistry." Josh, I should mention, is like Ted, a super whip smart graduate of Harvard Law School. "What's sophistry?" he asked. I told Josh what sophistry is, and he nodded. "What was his basis for that?" "He said it was because Clinton's Justice Department did a study that concluded that it hadn't worked." Josh frowned. "That's not true." Then he proceeded to explain to me what I had already explained to Ted. that there wasn't enough data available at the time for Clinton's Justice Department to reach a firm conclusion. Still, I asked Josh to go find the Justice Department report and put a memo together so I could be prepared the next time I saw Ted. Josh went and found the Clinton Justice Department's impact evaluation, which was published in 1997, fulfilling the law's requirement that an analysis of the assault weapons ban be completed within 30 months of its enactment. And guess what? Josh and I were entirely right, and Ted was entirely wrong. The Clinton Justice Department wrote, "Our best estimate is that the ban contributed to a 6.7% decrease in total gun murders between 1994 and 1995, beyond what would have been expected in view of ongoing crime, demographic, and economic trends. However, with only 1 year of post-ban data, we cannot rule out the possibility that this decrease in gun murders reflects chance year-to-year variation rather than a true effect of the ban." In other words, the early results suggested that the ban might be working, but that there wasn't enough data to draw a definitive conclusion, exactly what I had told Ted. The next time I spotted Ted on the Senate floor, I approached him and said, "Well, I guess you owe me an apology." "Why?" "Well," I said, getting ready to hit him with some facts, "the last time we spoke, you said that anybody who's for the assault weapons ban is engaged in sophistry." To which Ted replied, "No, I didn't." As in a flat denial, not, "No, I didn't." Or, "Really? I said that?" Or, "That doesn't sound like something I'd say." It was just an unqualified, unequivocal, "No, I didn't." And that's when I realized that Ted Cruz was really something special. During the Judiciary Committee's first hearing on the assault weapons ban, Ted had engaged in his own odious brand of sophistry. First, he said this: "The assault weapons ban that used to be in effect, according to the Department of Justice, quote, failed to reduce the average number of victims per gun murder incident or multiple gunshot wounds victims." A 1999 summary of the 1997 report did say that, but that's very different from saying that the ban didn't work. In fact, the sentence immediately preceding the one Ted quoted said, "Evidence suggests that the ban may have contributed to a reduction in the gun murder rate and murders of police officers by criminals armed with assault weapons." Ted continued, "Now that is the assessment of the United States Department of Justice, and that is in 1994. Actually, the Clinton Justice Department's report came out in 1997, and the language Ted cited actually came from a 1999 summary of that report. That kind of a mistake is very common in the Senate and in life, an innocent mistake, I'm sure, which is rare for someone as meticulous and or malevolent as Ted. Ted went on, "That was the Janet Reno Department of Justice under President Clinton that said the assault weapons ban was singularly ineffective." No, the report said nothing of the kind. The Microsoft Word thesaurus, which is even easier for me to consult while writing than the one built into Google, lists the following words as synonyms for singularly: unusually, especially, exceptionally, rarely, and surprisingly. So Cruz was saying that the DOJ had called the assault weapons ban exceptionally ineffective. Of course, not only does the report say no such thing, but it repeatedly makes the exact opposite point, which was that there was not yet enough evidence to draw any conclusive determination. Ted was being singularly dishonest and exceptionally smarmy. After our hearings on the assault weapons ban, we went into executive session to mark up the bill. When it came time for Ted to speak, he treated us all to a breathtakingly patronizing lecture directed at Senator Feinstein, who had been in the Senate for 20 years, compared to Ted's 2 months. After helpfully reminding Diane that the Constitution is our foundational document and that the First and Second Amendments of the Constitution are part of the Bill of Rights, Ted went in for the kill. And the question that I would pose to the senior senator from California is, would she deem it consistent with the Bill of Rights for Congress to engage in the same endeavor that we are contemplating doing with the Second Amendment in the context of the First or Fourth Amendment? Namely, would she consider it constitutional for Congress to specify that the First Amendment shall apply only to the following books and shall not apply to the books that Congress has deemed outside the protection of the Bill of Rights? You get what he was trying to say, right? The bill would have outlawed assault weapons while leaving other guns legal. And Ted was suggesting that this was equivalent to selectively banning books. If this sounds like a very private school debate club way to talk about gun safety, please rest assured that it was delivered in the most private school debate club tone possible, like an actor performing a monologue in which he plays an intolerably smug, self-righteous high school debater in a blue blazer with brass buttons, but way, way overdoing it. Ted's condescension hung in the air like the stench from a cat box in an apartment with 40 cats belonging to an elderly woman who had just been found dead. It was bad, is what I'm saying. Dick Durbin jumped in. Would the senator yield for a question? But Diane wanted to respond herself. Let me just make a couple of points in response. One, I am not a sixth grader. Barely containing her anger, she reminded Ted that not only had she been a member of the Judiciary Committee for 20 years, but before that, she had been the mayor of San Francisco, an office to which she ascended when her predecessor, George Moscone, was assassinated, along with Supervisor Harvey Milk. In fact, Diane had been the one who discovered Harvey Milk's body. "I've seen the bullets that implode," she growled at Ted. Diane finished by reassuring Ted that she was familiar with the Constitution and sarcastically thanking him for the lecture. There was a sort of stunned silence. Then Chairman Leahy noted that Dick Durbin had asked for the floor. "Mr. Chairman," said Dick, "I can't add anything to that." But Ted could. Instead of dissolving into a fine pink shame mist, he piped up to clap back at the distinguished public servant who had just taken him to the woodshed. "I would note," he oozed, "that the senior senator from California did not answer my question, which is, in her judgment, would it be consistent with the Constitution for Congress to specify which books are permitted and which books are not?" "Well," I chimed in, "I've got a book that I don't think the First Amendment would permit. It's called Ted Cruz is a Pedophile. That would be liable, unless, of course, you are a pedophile, which we don't know." No, I didn't say that, but man, I wanted to, and I kind of wish I had. Around that time, Amy Klobuchar was preparing to speak at the Gridiron Club dinner, an annual black tie affair held by the oldest and most prestigious organization for journalists in Washington. Traditionally, the president gives humorous remarks, as do two members of Congress, one from each party. For the record, Amy doesn't let me write jokes for her. That way, if someone asks her if I wrote any of her jokes, she can honestly say no. Besides, Amy's really funny and can fend for herself. But sometimes she'll run jokes by me, and every once in a while, I'll have a suggestion on how to punch up one or two. Now, this was in early March of 2013, just a couple weeks after a Carnival cruise ship had been towed in the harbor after almost a week stranded at sea because of an engine fire. The ship had been nicknamed the Poop Cruise because passengers said the hallways were flooded with human waste, which had inspired a joke that Amy ran by me. When most people think of a bad cruise, they think of Carnival, but we think of Ted. I thought that was pretty good, but suggested a rewrite, which I'll get to in a moment. The Thursday before the gridiron, as we were taking a series of votes on the floor, I noticed Amy going around to a few senators she had written jokes about. Ah, I thought, Amy's getting their blessing. Then I saw her walk up to Ted. I thought, this could be interesting. So I went right over and inserted myself into a conversation triangle. Ted, Amy smiled, I've written a joke about you for the gridiron, and I wanted to get your okay. Sure, Ted smiled back. What's the joke? Well, Amy smiled, here it is. When most people think of a difficult cruise, they think of Carnival. But we Democrats in the Senate think of Ted. I noticed, of course, that she had softened the joke a bit, changing a bad cruise to a difficult cruise, and changing we think of Ted to we Democrats in the Senate think of Ted. Ted smiled. Then he offered a suggestion. What if you changed a difficult cruise to a challenging cruise? Oh, my God, what a putz. Now the joke isn't funny. I could tell that Amy was thinking the same thing, and so could Ted. So before Amy could respond, he smiled even more broadly and said magnanimously, I'll tell you what, I believe in the First Amendment. You go ahead and tell your joke. Wow, that was patronizing. I decided to step in. Say, Ted, I smiled. I did a rewrite of Amy's joke, and I think it's a lot better. You want to hear it? Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Amy having two successive thoughts. One, oh no, Al's not going to do this. Two, but I definitely want to be here if he does. Ted was still smiling. Sure. Okay, here it is. When most people think of a cruise as full of shit, they think of Carnival. But we think of Ted. And there went Ted's smile. For once, he had no words. I nodded, turned around, and walked away. Keep in mind, this all happened within 2 months of Ted's arrival in Washington. There are senators who take 6 months slowly getting to know people and getting to know the institution before they even make their first floor speech, let alone manage to convince every other senator to hate them. Ted wasted no time pissing everybody off, including his fellow Republicans. A couple weeks before the gun debate, the Armed Services Committee held a hearing on Chuck Hagel's nomination to be defense secretary. Now, it wasn't unusual for a Republican senator to give an Obama appointee a hard time, but Chuck Hagel was a former Republican senator from Nebraska. The Republican side of the dais was packed with senators who had known and worked with and respected Hagel for decades. But Ted decided to deliver another Cruzian performance piece, questioning the source of payments that Hagel had received for speaking engagements after leaving the Senate and making an inflammatory insinuation. It is, at a minimum, relevant to know if that $200,000 that he deposited in his bank account came directly from Saudi Arabia, came directly from North Korea. Yeah, just like it would be relevant to know if you were a pedophile, Ted. But at least I had the good taste not to say that out loud, but instead to write it in a book 5 years later. Republicans were at least polite about brushing back the brash new senator, with Lindsey Graham saying Cruz's remarks were out of bounds. Democrats in the media were less restrained, comparing Ted's intimation to McCarthy-esque innuendo. It takes a special kind of jerk to get compared to Joe McCarthy just a month into your Senate career. Although it didn't help Ted that he bears more than a passing resemblance to McCarthy himself. Franny thinks he's the love child of McCarthy and Dracula. Of course, Ted has been leaving a bad taste in people's mouths his whole life. His college roommate, screenwriter Craig Mazin, had been warning people about Cruz since the moment he leapt onto the national stage in the 2012 election, and when Ted ran for president in 2016, Mazin was only too happy to share some memories of what young Ted Cruz had been like. As a freshman, he tweeted one day, I would get into senior parties because I was Ted's roommate, out of pity. He was that widely loathed. It's his superpower. Keep in mind, this is at Princeton. Ted Cruz was too much of a smug jerk to fit in at Princeton. And then he went to Harvard Law School, where, during his very first week, he created a study group. Hey, that's kind of human. Except that, in order to apply to be part of Ted's study group, you had to have gone to Harvard, Princeton, or Yale for college. GQ interviewed Ted's law school roommate, who explained, he said he didn't want anybody from minor Ivies, like Penn or Brown. Now, if I spent 1,000 years on a desert island, I couldn't come up with a more obnoxious way to show my new classmates that I was a world-class butthole. I could fill several chapters with Ted Cruz's awfulness, but I'll end with one of my favorite keepsakes from my time in the Senate. It was a picture taken during an especially long and tedious executive session of the Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, during which we discussed and voted on Tom Udall's proposed constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United decision. The amendment would have simply restored the power of Congress and the states to regulate and set reasonable limits on the raising and spending of money by candidates and others to influence elections. Such laws, of course, had existed for many years before the Supreme Court decided to wipe them all out with a 5-4 vote. Ted opposed this, of course, and spoke against it in pieces that added up to a good hour, making bogus point after bogus point, which was why the hearing was so long and tedious. This amendment here today, he said at one point, would repeal the free speech protections of the First Amendment. And this amendment, if adopted, would give Congress absolute authority to regulate the political speech of every single American with no limitations whatsoever. And later, any politician who put his or her name to an amendment taking away the free speech rights of every American, in my view, should be embarrassed. Stuff like that. He also tied together his blatant disregard for the truth, his relentless appetite for grandstanding, and his cringeworthy habit of making pop culture references in an argument that seemed designed just to irritate me, referring to the political satire on Saturday Night Live, specifically Tina Fey playing Sarah Palin. According to Ted, if Citizens United were to be reversed, Tina would not have been able to do her Sarah Palin on the show because NBC is a corporation. Of course, as I pointed out, Tina did Sarah Palin during the 2008 election, 2 years before the Citizens United decision. Danny Aykroyd did Carter before Citizens United. Phil Hartman did Reagan. Dana Carvey did George H.W. Bush. Hartman did Bill Clinton, as did Daryl Hammond. And Will Ferrell did George W. Bush, all before Citizens United. So even if you bought Ted's bogus argument that preventing corporations from pouring billions of dollars in dark money into shadowy super PACs was equivalent to outlawing any political speech on the public airwaves, this wasn't even a relevant example. It was just a dishonest and unpleasant man trying and failing to use pop culture to make a false argument. In fact, a few months later, he made the same argument in a floor speech where he added, Lorne Michaels could be put in jail under this amendment for making fun of any politician. Ted Cruz isn't just wrong about almost everything. He's impossible to work with. And he doesn't care that he's impossible to work with. And that's why, even when the choice was between Ted Cruz, who was a sitting member of the United States Senate, and Donald Trump, who was Donald Trump, establishment Republicans couldn't bring themselves to rally behind Cruz. Even if you like what he stands for, the most he'll ever be able to accomplish is being an obnoxious wrench in the gears of government, like when he led the government shutdown over the Affordable Care Act. Real senatoring requires that you build productive relationships with your colleagues. And Ted just isn't that kind of guy. Which brings me to that photograph from the hearing. Now, you're not going to see it, but in the picture, you see Dick Durbin just painfully staring out to middle distance, just in anguish out of boredom. Me, painfully bored. Josh staring in boredom. And Cruz talking. And has the inscription, "Sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words of sophistry." Chapter 38, Bulletproof. After the massacre at Sandy Hook, a number of my Republican colleagues responded by saying something on the order of, "This isn't just about guns. It's about the culture and mental health." As someone who'd been working on mental health issues since I got to the Senate, I knew that a number of these colleagues had never expressed any interest in the subject. It was like they were checking off a box by saying the words mental and health and saying them in the right order. Even worse, by raising mental health only in the context of gun violence, they were stigmatizing mental illness. The shooters in Newtown and Aurora and Tucson and Orlando were demented. And, of course, early intervention can help avert some acts of violence. But the fact is that people with mental illness are, on the whole, no more likely to be violent and are actually more likely to be victims of violence than the general population. Virtually every family in America is touched by a behavioral health problem, mental illness or addiction. Addressing these issues in a smart, comprehensive, and compassionate way will relieve suffering, save families and lives, give us a more productive workforce, save tons of money in law enforcement and our prisons and in emergency room visits, and yes, maybe prevent someone from becoming so psychotic that they shoot up a movie theater or a nightclub or an elementary school. My friend Paul Wellstone was profoundly affected by watching his brother struggle with depression. And one of his Republican colleagues, New Mexico's Pete Domenici, was profoundly affected by his daughter's schizophrenia. So in the Senate, they teamed up to try to help Americans get the care they need. Back then, one barrier to getting that care was the exceptionally high cost of treatment. Many health insurance plans would cover surgery for a broken arm, but not medication for crippling anxiety or treatment for a drug addiction. Mental health issues were seen, at least within the health insurance market, as somehow less important or less real or, in any case, less worthy of coverage. Wellstone and Domenici tried to change that by fighting for what was known as mental health parity, which would simply require insurance plans that cover mental health services to cover them to the same extent as medical and surgical services. This extremely simple, extremely common sense, extremely humane reform didn't become law until October 2008. Yep, Paul Wellstone's most meaningful legislative achievement came 6 years after his death. The fight to pass the Wellstone-Domenici Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act was led in the House by Democrat Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island and Republican Jim Ramstead of Minnesota. Both are recovering alcoholics, but Patrick had the harder road to recovery. John F. Kennedy wrote a book called Profiles in Courage. But to me, the family's greatest profile in courage may well be Patrick. He never let his own very public and very embarrassing struggles with addiction and mental illness keep him from fighting to help others with mental health and addiction disorders get the care they needed. My own interest in mental health issues came partly from how much I respected Paul's work on the issue, and partly because, as you may recall, I too had been affected by loved ones who suffered from a behavioral disease, alcohol and chemical addiction. When I got to the Senate, I was eager to do my part to carry on Paul's legacy and, if possible, expand upon it. First step, pushing the Department of Health and Human Services to finalize the regulations prescribed by the Wellstone-Domenici Act. It was complex, painstaking work, and I was responsible for almost none of it. It was undertaken mostly by my health care legislative staff, working with the Department of Health and Human Services. and it remains a work in progress. Wellstone Domenici is now fully implemented, and the Affordable Care Act built on its success by requiring that all policies sold through the exchange cover behavioral health services, including addiction treatment, which has been a lifesaver for many during the ongoing opioid crisis. But we are still nowhere near where we need to be in making sure that people who need treatment for mental illness and addiction can always get it. Then came the rash of mass shootings and the rash of national conversations about mental health. Lots of people were declaring that we needed to do something, but nobody was really clear on what exactly we could or should do. In frustration, I asked the president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness how to respond. She gave me a one-word answer. Schools. She arranged a roundtable at a school in the Mounds View School District. The school had adopted an approach to mental health that seemed to be working. All the adults in the school community, from the principal and the teachers to the bus driver and the lunch ladies, had been taught what it looks like when a kid is dealing with mental health problems. If they saw a kid who seemed to be struggling, they could ask a mental health professional, a counselor, a psychologist, a social worker, or a therapist, to check in with the student and determine whether he or she had a serious mental health issue. That professional would connect the child with mental health services in the Mounds View community. At the round table, three mothers raved about what a difference this program had made for their children and their families. One in particular, Katie Johnson, made a profound impact on me. Katie told me that she was a single mother of two, a 9-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter. "My son," she said, "was completely out of control. So my life was completely out of control. I was in total despair." One day, Katie got a call from a woman who introduced herself as the mental health advocate for Katie's son. "She's become my best friend," Katie told me. Katie's son was diagnosed with ADHD and Asperger's. They treated him, and he completely turned around. Now he's doing well in school, and he's taking Taekwondo. Katie looked me straight in the eye with the confidence of someone who had gone through a horrific ordeal and found herself safely on the other side. After years of chaos and frustration, her son was finally on the right track, and her own life finally felt manageable. Pointing to her heart, she told me proudly, "I am now bulletproof." I thought, let's do this. There was a gun bill working its way through the Senate, so I added an amendment that would fund training for people who work in schools to identify warning signs of mental illness and help detect and treat issues as early as possible. My colleagues understood the wisdom of the idea right away, and my provision passed by a nearly unanimous vote. But as you may recall, the gun bill failed. Still, the idea stuck. Soon after, we got $100 million in new funding to improve mental health services in schools, and we've gotten more since. This money has helped train a lot of adults in schools to intervene when a student is having trouble, and it's helped schools to hire a lot more counselors and social workers to treat those students, and it's helped a lot of kids. But not every kid. On an issue like mental health, there's never a big, dramatic final victory. There's never a signing ceremony where the president officially abolishes undiagnosed mental illness once and for all. Kids and adults struggle with mental illness every day, and too many of them never get the help they need. And that's just kind of how it works. Sometimes you work your whole life to do something simple and noble, and it doesn't happen until 6 years after your death. Sometimes it never happens at all. Sometimes you get 94 of your colleagues to vote for your amendment, but the bill itself fails on a cynical partisan filibuster. Sometimes you see a breaking news banner on the TV in your office and something awful has happened, and you get the creeping sensation that the whole sad national conversation is about to begin again. But sometimes you can make a little progress, and sometimes you get to see what that progress looks like. A few days after we secured that first batch of funding, I went to Westwood Elementary School in Bloomington, Minnesota for another roundtable. There was real excitement among the 20-some people who had heard about the new funding for programs like the one that was working in their school. Westwood has a therapist in residence, so parents don't have to take the better part of a day to pick their kid up to ferry them to and from an appointment. A 10-year-old boy told me how much his therapist, a cheerful young woman in her early 30s, had helped him. When he sees her in the hall during recess, he said, he gives her a big high five. Talk about destigmatizing. When you're a senator and you go to these roundtables, it's often just one person after another telling you incredibly sad or depressing or inspiring stories. Me being me, I have a ritual to sort of puncture the emotions so I can switch gears and get my head into the next event. And after this roundtable, my driver, Brett, and I walked out to the car, climbed in, buckled up, and per our ritual, I nodded at Brett and said, "Fooled him again." But this time I added, almost to myself, "I'm a good senator." Chapter 39. Cracks in My Soul. The Democratic Senator's Serenity Prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot legislate, the courage to legislate the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference, and the patience to explain that difference to my donors. Probably the most enjoyable part of public service is the fundraising. That's because you get to spend endless hours on the phone talking with people from all walks of life, though mainly rich people, and also you mostly talk to their voicemail or assistants. Not only that, but when you do manage to get them on the phone, the people on the other end are super excited to talk to you because they know exactly why you're calling, to ask them for their support. And if you're not sitting in a small room with your call time manager, calling people for 3 or 4 hours at a stretch, you may very well be flying across the country to speak to your supporters at the sumptuous home of a wealthy donor who wisely chose not to go into public service. Or even better, you might be flying across the country in the middle of the night. Flying in the middle of the night gives you plenty of time to examine the choices you've made in your life, or to sleep, but also to write thank you notes to donors. Okay, let's back up. Unfortunately, unless you're very rich or not interested in winning, you need to raise money if you're going to run for office. You need the resources to put a team together, to rent office space, to buy phones and computers and printers and toner, to feed volunteers, to travel around your state, to make ads, and to put the ads on the air. So before I go any further, let me just thank everyone who has ever contributed to my campaigns. The vast majority of you are not wealthy and give 5, 10, or 25 of your hard-earned dollars. In fact, more than 90% of the donations I've received are $50 or less. Without the generosity of people who don't own sumptuous homes, I would not be in the position I am to fight for the things we believe in. Despite my success with direct mail and online fundraising from small donors, I have to raise a lot of money the old-fashioned way, by picking up the phone and calling rich people. And it takes a little trial and error to discover what works and what gets you a restraining order. My first fundraising call in late 2005 was to a successful St. Paul lawyer, John Farisee. Though we had never met, John took my call because he was familiar with my work as a comedian, author, and radio host. I made my pitch for the PAC I had started, and John immediately agreed to give. How much was I looking for? I peered down at the notes on my call sheet. Well, I guess $5,000. John said, "Okay." I paused and then asked, "Are you sure?" I remember this only because John told the story to gales of laughter at one of my fundraising dinners in 2014. Call time is just you and your call time manager, a young staffer who's printing out and handing you call sheets and reminding you about any special information you might need to remember. Maybe the person you're calling missed your last event because they were at their mother's funeral or at a child's hockey game. Or maybe they particularly love your work on fighting climate change. Sometimes you dial the phone, other times your call time manager does. Sometimes you have to do all the talking, sometimes the person you're calling talks. Sometimes they talk too much. As you dial, you peruse the person's giving history, every donation they've ever made over the past several election cycles, not just to you, but to everyone. That's all public information, by the way. Also on my call sheets are notes from A.J. Goodman, the former death row attorney who has been my national fundraising director for the last 11 years. A.J. makes the best call sheets, which include reminders like, don't call the home, the wife hates politics, or call her cell, he's a Republican, or they're divorced, no more Sharon, no more Sharon money. Am I giving you a good sense of what call time is like? Did you tune out when I mentioned giving history and then perk up a little bit when you heard death row? I don't know how interesting this sounds, but call time is less interesting than that. It's not uncommon to have 3 straight hours of call time scheduled as part of your day. During my recount, I often did 8 hours of call time in a day. It's brutal. But I probably hate call time less than most elected officials do. See, when I was in comedy, I used to edit, which involves sitting in an edit room for hours on end while a skilled craftsman makes the edits that you and your co-writer or the director request. It means reviewing all the takes for pieces of the best performances and looking for different camera angles and sizes, close-up, two-shot, wide, to cut around weaker performance moments. This can be more or less interesting than it sounds, depending on what you're editing and whether you're the one calling the shots. But whatever the case, I would always make a conscious decision to enjoy myself. You're going to be in this room for 5 hours, I would tell myself. You might as well enjoy it. That's my call time philosophy, too. Just as I try to make fundraising emails fun for the people who read them, I try to make call time fun for myself and my call time manager and for whomever I'm calling. Let's say I get the assistant of an attorney in Dallas. I'll say, hi, this is Al Franken calling for Mr. Hudnut. I'm sorry, but Mr. Hudnut is in a meeting. All right, well, I'm calling to invite him and Sandra to a fundraiser for me in Dallas on October 11th. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Hudnut will be out of the country on October 11th. Uh-huh, I say. And will the Hudnut's checkbook be out of the country? That almost always gets a laugh, and often money. Over the course of the many hours I have spent in call time during the last decade, I have composed, as a sanity maintenance device, a musical entitled Call Time the Musical. The musical takes place in a call room with me and my call time manager, a table, and a phone. The audience can hear the phone on the other end. While it's ringing, I sing to the tune of Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. Please answer the phone, Howard Goldfein. You maxed to me last cycle. Oh, won't you be home, Howard Goldfein. Now, I would have sung that here, but we have a legal issue. Anyway, if there's no answer, the audience hears the Goldfein's outgoing message, an adorable little girl saying, the Goldfeins aren't home now. And then I leave a charming message. Elise, this is Al Franken. You have a very young-sounding voice. I guess Howard robbed the cradle. Listen, I'm going to be in Cleveland Thursday, April 7th, for a fundraiser at the home of Danny and Marilyn Lasky in Shaker Heights. And I'd love for you both to come. You can call A.J. Goodman at 555-287-6543 for all the details. A.J.'s a she, a female person. She's a woman. Then I hang up and sing Call Time's signature tune, I Left a Message. It's the signature tune for 2 reasons. First, because it's so catchy and upbeat. And second, because I sing it roughly 75 times over the course of the show, which lasts 6 hours with no intermission unless I have to go to the bathroom. Also, it provides almost all of Call Time's production values. Because while I sing I Left a Message, The chorus members, who include 6 ballerinas, 4 jugglers, some acrobats, and several chimpanzees riding tricycles, enter, do their stuff, and sing their parts. Starts with me. I left a message on the phone. Woo! I left a message. They were not home. No, no, no. That was the chorus going, no, no, no. I left a message. Oh, yes, I did. Ow, ow. I left a message. I do not kid. He left a message. Oh, yes, he did. Wah, wah. He left a message. He does not kid. Yay! Then the orchestra plays them off to thunderous applause. Seriously, without Call Time the Musical, my call time manager and I would go crazy. You might be wondering who this call time manager is and how he or she can stand to do this job. After all, he or she has to sit through all these calls too, but never gets to talk to anyone but me. On the other hand, I am raising the funds that will be used to pay his or her salary, so there's that. But because there is a burnout rate, I've actually had several call time managers over the years. Each has contributed in their own way to Call Time the Musical. The Beltway sensation Brian Heenan made a key breakthrough when he started to lavish praise upon my performance with every call. That was a great message, Brian would say with absolute sincerity after I left a voicemail. If I were her, I'd go to the fundraiser. Or when I'd hang up after a long call with a prospective donor, Brian would say, on this end, from what I heard, that was a great conversation. I bet she maxes out. Now, Andy Osborne, who replaced Brian when the original cast departed, developed a running bit based on my suggestion that Rain Man would be the ideal call time manager. Definitely call the house, 555-681-2372. Last time you called, January 27, 2009, you called the office. Definitely called the office, 555-724-0966. The assistant, Brenda Downey, said definitely call the house. Or, definitely max out to you in 2008. Gary gave $2,400 on April 12, 2007 for the primary. Attended Larry David event. Definitely attended. Another $2,400 for general. Definitely June 21st, 2008, summer solstice. Mary Alla also gave the full $4,800, also at the Larry David event. She's a big Larry David fan. Definitely loves Curb Your Enthusiasm. Definitely. Would definitely sleep with Larry David. She said that? Yes, but I added definitely. She just said, I'd sleep with Larry David. Rain Man, she was joking. No reaction from Rain Man. Now, you'll notice I referred to Larry David. This is more than just a casual name drop like my earlier mentions of call time manager Brian Heenan and Dallas super lawyer Mr. Hudnut. One of the things Norm Coleman attacked me for during that first campaign was that I received a lot of campaign money from the left coast Hollywood elite, who are poisoning our culture and contributing to the breakdown of the American family. And indeed, over the years, I've gotten a lot of support from people in show business, especially people I worked with over my 35 years in the industry. So as Republican lines of attack went, this was among the least dishonest, but that didn't make it any less silly. For one thing, like many Republicans, Coleman was raising much of his money from big oil and big pharma and big insurance. So I was happy to admit that I was raising money from what I called big comedy. It's hard to argue that Ben Stiller has been a worse influence on our country than ExxonMobil, even if you were very disappointed with Zoolander 2. But the real difference was that I had actually worked in big comedy. These were people I had made movies and TV shows with. These were people who know me personally. These were my friends. Norm Coleman, on the other hand, had never been a wildcatter in the oil fields. He had never developed a life-saving drug in the research lab of a pharmaceutical company. He hadn't spent his career before politics as an actuary in the insurance business. I got money from big comedy because my friends wanted to support me. My opponent got money from big oil and big pharma and big insurance because they wanted something from him. This is why I and many other people have long called for public financing of elections. It's not just that all this fundraising is a huge pain and a distraction from the work our elected officials should be spending their time doing, reading briefing books, or just books, talking to experts, crafting legislation, and meeting with constituents. The role of big money in our politics gives special interests a bigger megaphone than people who can't write big checks. Of course, the influence of special interests is now greater than ever, thanks to the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision in Citizens United, and the Republicans' refusal to let us do anything to bring some transparency and accountability back to our elections. In the court's majority opinion, Justice Kennedy tried to reassure people that allowing corporations, unions, and wealthy individuals to spend unlimited money in elections is really nothing to worry about. With the advent of the Internet, Kennedy wrote, prompt disclosure of expenditures can provide shareholders and citizens with the information needed to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. Well, in theory. Except that under Citizens United, there was no requirement that these expenditures actually be disclosed, which made it kind of hard for anyone to be held accountable. Now, we Democrats tried to pass a law that would actually mandate prompt disclosure of expenditures by the new groups that sprung up like weeds after Citizens United so that shareholders and citizens could use that information to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. We called it the Democracy is Strengthened by Casting Light on Spending in Elections Act, which by happy coincidence we later discovered could be shortened to the Disclose Act. Like any bill, the Disclose Act would need 60 votes to pass the Senate, and at the time, we had only 59. Which shouldn't have been a problem. Given their past statements about the importance of disclosure, you'd have thought that Republicans would have been lining up to co-sponsor the Disclose Act. In a floor speech, I quoted my colleagues who had voted against the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law that passed in 2002 on the grounds that we didn't need limits on campaign donations if we only had disclosure. For example, there was Chuck Grassley. We can try to regulate ethical behavior by politicians, but the surest way to cleanse the system is to let the sunshine in. There was Lamar Alexander, who I can't imitate. I support campaign finance reform, but to me that means individual contributions, free speech, and full disclosure. There was Orrin Hatch. The issue is expenditures, 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 and the issue, the real issue, if we really want to do something about campaign finance reform, is disclosure, disclosure, disclosure. Even Mitch McConnell had said, public disclosure of campaign contributions and spending should be expedited so voters can judge for themselves what is appropriate. But as much as my Republican colleagues had sung the praises of disclosure and hailed Justice Kennedy's decision in Citizens United as wise jurisprudence, Senate Republicans secretly knew they had been handed a huge advantage thanks to the most outrageous act of judicial activism in a generation, and they weren't about to look this gift horse in the mouth. The day of the disclose vote, it was clear that the Republican filibuster would hold. I was a bit peeved at the hypocrisy, and after casting my own futile vote to move the bill forward, I stood in the well during the rest of the vote to give my good friends a bit of friendly crap. This led to the single dumbest thing a colleague has ever said to me, which is quite a high bar. After watching one of the Republicans who had spoken about the importance of disclosure 8 years earlier vote no on the Disclose Act, I asked him rather churlishly, what happened to sunshine is the best disinfectant? I'm protecting the Constitution, he replied, equally churlishly, then moved on. Another Republican, however, felt the need to defend him, also churlishly. Well, there are parts of the bill we're not comfortable with, he said. Okay, I replied. Name one thing in the bill you have a problem with. My colleague blanked and, without responding, turned to the clerk, voting no. Another Republican colleague, having overheard the last two exchanges, said to me, civilly, I admit, though I thought I could still detect a hint of churlishness, well, the bill treats different entities differently. This was a line of argument Republicans used often, usually claiming that Democrats wanted to place new obstacles on the political power of corporations while further empowering labor unions. No, it doesn't, I said, having plenty of practice knocking down this bogus claim. It treats unions the same as corporations and the same as individuals. Now, here comes the single dumbest thing a colleague has ever said to me. Well, let's say the New York Times prints an editorial. It doesn't have to disclose. My jaw dropped. I gave my colleague a second to figure out why that had been a spectacularly stupid argument, but it didn't seem like he was getting it. It's in the New York Times, I explained, as unchurlishly as I could manage. Oh, he realized. Right. Then he turned to the clerk and voted no. The proliferation of money in politics is a huge problem. And as I'll explain in the next chapter, it has some pretty terrible consequences. But does this mean that elected officials are all bought and paid for? The truth I've discovered is a little more complicated. Campaign contributions don't buy votes. What they buy is access. That's why lobbyists write campaign checks. They're not bribes, they're grease. They enable those lobbyists to come to fundraisers where they get to talk to you while you're trying to remember their names. Gross, right? And it is. I hear from a lot of lobbyists, and yes, some of them are every bit as transactional as you're imagining. But others, often the more effective ones, are actually passionate about the issue they're representing. And while lobbying, and all the money associated with it, offers lots of opportunities for corruption, lobbying itself isn't inherently corrupt. Many lobbyists represent good causes like solar energy or Alzheimer's research or a woman's reproductive rights. They may have donated to you not in order to buy your support going forward, but because you've been supporting their good cause all along. And more often than not, you're not meeting with them because of a check they wrote, but rather because you're on the same team. You're strategizing together about how to move the ball forward and trading useful information about how to achieve a shared goal. That doesn't mean I'm pro-lobbyist. In fact, during my first campaign, I called for a lifetime lobbying ban on former members of Congress. It didn't seem right to me that after holding the high honor of public service, you could just cash out and make millions off your access to former colleagues. And it still doesn't. I still want to ban former members of Congress from becoming lobbyists, and for that matter, I still want public financing for elections so current and prospective members of Congress don't have to spend so much time fundraising. But the issue looks different from the inside than it did from the outside. In 2005, Norm Coleman voted for an energy bill that gave subsidies to the oil and gas industry. It was easy to draw a direct line between those votes and the money he got from big oil, and during the campaign, I drew that line with great enthusiasm. Norm's response was always that the same bill created the Renewable Fuel Standard, or RFS, which includes the ethanol mandate. Now, the oil and gas industry doesn't have a big presence in Minnesota, but we grow a lot of corn and soybeans, and corn ethanol and other biofuels like biodiesel produced from soybean oil have been extremely important to the economy of rural Minnesota. In other words, the RFS is good for my state. The oil and gas subsidies in the bill were bad for everyone except the oil and gas industry and oil and gas states. But while I'm sure Norm was less bothered by those subsidies than I would have been, the truth is that, on balance, I might well have wound up casting the same vote he did. Was it unfair for me to say that Norm was in the pocket of big oil? Nah. But was it entirely accurate to say that he only voted for this bill because he had been bought off? Probably not. In 2010, I took a trip to Israel and met with some members of the Knesset. I'd never given it any thought before, but every member of the Knesset represents all of Israel. There is no member representing the northern suburbs of Tel Aviv. Our system is different. House members in Congress represent their districts. Senators represent our states. I was elected to represent the people of Minnesota. When I'm trying to decide how to vote on a bill, whether or not something is good for my state is always at the top of my mind. But of course, it's not even close to the only consideration. Does the stuff in this bill I like outweigh the stuff I don't like? If I vote for it, can I get the senator who sponsored it to vote for something of mine? If I vote against it, can we get a better deal later? What does my staff think? What do the experts I trust say? Has Atul Gawande weighed in at all? Every so often, we have to pass what's known as a continuing resolution, which extends current levels of funding so we can keep the government open and functioning until we can agree on an actual budget. Often, this is a big end-of-the-year package and may contain any number of things that are just awful, and also any number of things that are great, including one or two pieces of legislation that I myself have authored and have been fighting to pass for several years. Also, if the thing doesn't pass, the government shuts down. Obviously, there's a point at which a continuing resolution could be so bad that I'd have to vote against it, even if it meant voting against stuff I liked or even authored or even shutting the government down. But where is that point? I mean, it would have to be a really bad continuing resolution in order for me to vote against it, unless I knew it was going to pass even without my vote, in which case maybe I could vote against it as a protest of the stuff I didn't like. Then again, on principle, shouldn't you always vote as if you were the deciding vote? I used to think that, but I gave up a while ago, and I can't even remember what the hell that was about. The point is, there are all sorts of reasons why someone might vote for something imperfect, or worse, that have absolutely nothing to do with campaign contributions. Former Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank once said, "I only voted once for someone who believes 100% of what I believe, and that's when I voted for myself the first time." The fact is that being in the institution changes the way you look at how Washington works. And you have to work hard to make sure that it doesn't change who you are. Something a constituent warned me about after I'd been in the Senate for a year or so. The woman, who was about my age, with salt and pepper hair, approached me after I spoke at a reception honoring the year's best in Twin Cities Theater. As she stared at me for a while, I could see concern growing in her eyes. "I can see out of physical reality," she informed me. "Uh-huh. You've seen corruption, and it's affected you. It's put cracks in your soul." Now, that's not the kind of thing you like to hear about your soul. But she assured me that I was a loving person with a great soul. It's just that it had been badly wounded since I'd been in Washington. She wanted me to heal my soul so it could become green and clean and good. I told her that I was going to get a massage the next day, and she thought that was a good start. The massage helped, but normally what helps my soul is getting something done for people, improving people's lives, as Paul Wellstone would say. There are plenty of potentially soul-destroying aspects of running for office and serving in the Senate. Fundraising can certainly be one of them. But you keep your eye on the prize. And it's all worth every phone call, every plane ride, every thank you note, if you can get health insurance for 20 million people. If you meet a mom whose child is alive because you help to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions can get insured. If you can get mental health care treated the same as medical care. If you can prevent an undocumented mother from being deported and separated from her American citizen children. If you can preserve net neutrality. If you can keep a family in their home. It's a privilege to be a United States senator. Not only because you get to make this stuff happen, but because you get to work with people who are working every day themselves to make this stuff happen, Americans of goodwill. Democrats and Republicans, affluent and struggling, of every color and every faith, and non-believers, who are working to improve our country and our world. Now give me some money.